Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the War Room. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, coming to you live this Thursday afternoon. Very glad to have you here with us. We got a big show today. We've got a couple of big guests. We'll be joined by Frank Wright in this first hour and then Jay Dyer in the second hour. I got to say, well, one of the greatest things about doing the War Room now is I get to watch people on Alex's show and be sitting there hearing all the things they're talking about and going, you know, they'll touch on genetics. I'm like, ooh, we'll expand on that later. I get to revisit some of the topics that I hear touched on in the Alex Jones show. We'll have Jay Dyer in and go a little bit deeper on some of those topics. Very excited for that. And then, of course, Frank Wright has some pretty very interesting information about surrogacy and a lot of other stuff having to do with traditional Christian values. So very excited to talk to him as well. Stay tuned for all that, but we'll begin today, as we do every day, with our Daily Dispatch. All right, here it is, folks, your Daily Dispatch for Thursday, the 23rd of October, 2025. FBI raids NBA gambling ring tied to Italian mafia. More than 30 people arrested, including Trailblazers coach Chauncey Billups and Heat's Terry Rozier, I guess. FBI Director Cash Patel on Thursday announced the arrest of more than 30 people across 11 states, including the head coach of the Trailblazers and Miami Heat player Terry Rozier, as part of a takedown of a massive sports gambling ring, which included a poker scheme and sports rigging. So yes, folks, if you've ever been convinced that the professional sports that you were watching was somehow rigged because it's just impossible that your team does that at that moment, yeah, you're probably right, actually. Yeah, no, everything's corrupt. It all sucks. Meanwhile, Trump backs away from sending federal troops to San Francisco after pleas from tech leaders. President Trump said Thursday he's calling off plans to deploy federal troops to San Francisco after speaking to the city's mayor and following backlash from the tech industry. The federal government was preparing to surge San Francisco, California on Saturday, but friends of mine, this is Trump saying this, but friends of mine who live in the area called last night to ask me not to go forward with the surge in that the mayor, Daniel Lurie, was making substantial progress. So, of course, it's the same case all over the country, whether it's Chicago or Portland or L.A. The only reason we send in federal troops is because the local officers are literally refusing to do their job and making everything less safe. So if this is the solution, like I've been calling for every time we talk about this, every time we watch J.B. Pritzker, you know, pontificate. I don't know if that's the right word. He's the type of guy that doesn't pontificate. He bloviates, actually. Bloviate is a better word for him. Every time he bloviates about, you know, the horror of having federal agents sent to a city, it's like, well, the solution is just you take care of the crime, dummy. So good. It's good to see that, you know, San Francisco is like, oh, you're going to send troops? Then I'll do it. Then don't worry about it. Then we'll take care of it. We don't wait till dad gets home. No, I'll just do it now. Yeah, good. You should be doing it already, traitors. Meanwhile, Israel, quote, would lose all support from U.S. if it annexed West Bank, Trump warns. Seemingly putting the kibosh on the Israel rights dream of applying sovereignty to parts of the West Bank, U.S. President Donald Trump has said Israel will lose all support from the United States if it tries to move ahead with annexation, something that they're very much intent on doing. And they're also bombing Lebanon to a very large degree right now. And it's typical, and we sort of knew this was going to happen because Israel's like a drug addict, and their drug is war with their neighbors, and they can't kick it. And they constantly need a new supply. So, yeah, as soon as they were sort of hamstrung in Gaza, they went to the West Bank. And, in fact, 71 settler attacks have been recorded in the West Bank in just the last week. So no sign of slowing down. But they're going to have to if they want to get support from America into the future. Meanwhile, illegal immigrant truck driver charged with DUI killing three people in California crash. This guy was released into the U.S. under Biden. So another death at the hands of the Biden open border brigade. And finally, we have this. IDF strikes Hezbollah training camp in Lebanon with the IDF, bombing their neighbors because America supports them endlessly for some godforsaken reason. That's your Daily Dispatch brought to you by TheAlexJonesStore.com. Go to TheAlexJonesStore.com today. Get your bovine colostrum plus or any of the incredible supplements. Keep us on the air and in the fight far, far into the future. Frank Wright on the other side. Stay with us.
Alex Jones, patriot, a man they tried to silence. They came for his voice, his platform, his life, but they can't stop him. gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's most unstoppable force. Alex Jones will be that man. Better than he was before. Better. Stronger. Faster. Louder.
Go to alexjonesapp.com, the number one news app in the world.
Yes!
You're watching The War Room with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now on X.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is The War Room. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, joined in studio by Frank Wright. Frank Wright is a fearless journalist and commentator dedicated to reporting on the most critical issues facing Western civilization. As a regular contributor to LifeSide News, his work focuses on the defense of life, liberty, and faith, exposing the powerful forces of cultural decay and globalism that threaten these foundational pillars. You can find him on frankwriter.com. That's W-R-I-G-H-T-E-R.com. Frank provides in-depth analysis and cuts through the noise of the mainstream media. And you can follow him on X at Frank Wrighter. Frank, welcome to the show, sir.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure. And of course, you were on with Alex last week, I guess. Was it just 2 days ago? I can't even remember anymore. But, you were on with, you did an interview with Brianna as well. And you're here to talk about surrogacy. You call it America's national disgrace. What about surrogacy to you is so objectionable?
Well, you see, the problem with surrogacy really is it's a very well-marketed and very lucrative international industry that's increasingly focused in the United States, which is the dominant market of surrogacy worldwide. But when you look behind it, it's basically an industry of evil. The marketing's very slick. It looks extremely altruistic. They even use that word. But the more you look into it, the more evil you see. Mm. And the reason why I should say, and it's a terrible thing to say, that it's America's national disgrace, but it really is. It's being increasingly criminalized and recognized as evil around the world. And I would like to point out that recognition of evil includes atheists, feminists, abortionists, liberals, left-wingers, the United Nations and the European Union. And it is embarrassing that, discredited organizations such as these would be able to recognize evil, but the United States government would not. There's currently no federal law governing surrogacy, and anyone from anywhere in the world can come to the United States and buy a baby, and they do, which is why the industry is booming in America.
So that's shocking. I've looked into surrogacy a little bit. I didn't realize there's no laws around it. How could that possibly be the case? I mean, that's crazy.
It did. Look, a lot of the things that you say about this business just sound like baseless clickbait that you're going to say them just to get. We know that we live in an information saturated age, but everything here is true, and I do provide evidence for it. There's an overview article that I've written on Substack that says America's national disgrace, surrogacy, and it provides all the receipts. Why is it permitted like this? There's no federal law governing it. There's no federal position. It's individually permissioned in states. And to be brief about it, this began in the 1990s. And there was a very foundational case in 1993 that basically asserted the rights of the commissioning parent, that's to say the people who buy the baby, to recognize that fertilized embryo or the baby as their property. It is property law that governs these arrangements, and it was established in 1993. If that sounds astonishing, so the people who then organized these surrogacy agencies, which really began 2 years after this, about 1995, with Circle Surrogacy and people like John Weltman, they're lawyers as well, and they went around states in the United States winning legal cases, commissioning this so widely that now there's only one state in America, which is Louisiana, in which it is criminal or illegal to do this. Everywhere else, you could do it.
That is shocking because it. I mean, you're talking about you're not again using clickbait or hyperbolic language when you say people are literally buying human beings.
If you want to look this up, there's the case of C.M. Capital C.M. And C.M. was the his name's been released was the name of the man who commissioned the babies, and I think this is around 2017. This man was an American man, and he decided to buy a baby from a woman through an agency. And it's typical that the woman who gives birth to the baby is not called a mother, she's called a gestational carrier, doesn't meet the man concerned. Now, this man turned out to be a single deaf man in his 50s living in his parents' basement with insufficient income or life skills or capability to look after children. It gets worse. She was implanted with three fertilized embryos in a typical procedure, but they all went live. When the man found out she was going to have triplets, he demanded that she had an abortion.
Mm.
And then he demanded that she abort at least one of them, and she started to get concerned. She found out about his condition, about his life, about his state, the fact he was old, he was disabled, didn't have much money, and she was concerned he couldn't look after the babies. To cut a long story short, because of these concerns, she had to give birth with an armed security guard on the hospital door. She wasn't allowed to have anyone with her while she was cut open and the babies were taken out of her. A screen was placed over her stomach. They were immediately removed and transported to the buyer. She tried to retrieve custody through the courts, and the judge told her what happens to those children afterwards is not the business of the court. This man owns them. That's the end of that. The final nail in the coffin was that the Supreme Court refused to hear her case, and so she couldn't get custody of the children.
Wow. And that, okay, there's just so many things. So when did that happen? Was that in the 90s?
2017 to 2019.
Oh, so that was more recent. Okay. So did it start off this crazy, or has it progressively gotten crazier? How did this even come about? Like, what were the arguments that were made in favor of surrogacy to get this whole thing going in the first place? Because as you're describing it, it's like, how would this ever be implemented? But what was the argument to get this going in the first place that people bought into?
Well, you must remember that this, like many other industries, if you like, industries of death or evil, which is how I would describe it, is lucrative. And so what you seek in that test case in 1993 is you seek to establish a legal precedent where it makes it easier for people to do this. So you can, and if once you've established whose rights are what, once you've established that the buyer owns the fertilized embryo and the babies, and that the surrogate mother has no rights at all, then you have a clean transaction. And then you can go and legally permission that by test cases in other states. And indeed, you can set up agencies to do this. Circle Surrogacy was founded by John Weltman, who is a homosexual man who had a homosexual male partner and wanted to have a baby. And he found it very difficult, he said. So 2 years after this test case, he set up Circle Surrogacy, which dealt exclusively to men like himself to supply babies to same-sex male couples. It's now one of the biggest surrogacy agencies in the United States and has actually provided legal precedent and advice and pressure to, well, for example, Israel. A lot of his market was Israeli gay men coming to buy babies in the US. But because of the lucrative nature of this market and his legal pressuring, industry pressuring, lobbying, partnered with the State Department in 2016, for example, the Israeli government legalized it in, I think, between 2019 and 22, when it was formally banned. So now you can buy, if you're a homosexual man, you can buy babies in Israel as well, thanks to him. And he's had a worldwide influence and has gone around the states, United States of America, as well as other leading surrogacy agents. They're all lawyers, and they all do this intentionally to build their market. It's currently worth about $20 billion worldwide, but by 2034, it's supposed to be worth $200 billion.
Well, that's a compelling argument, I guess, to some people. $200 billion. It seems like, and maybe this is a little off topic, but it seems like something happened in the 90s because that was the same time that you had Dr. Kevorkian going around with the, killing people with his van, you know, but basically normalizing eugenics, which now we see it's like the number one cause of death in certain provinces in Canada. tens of thousands of people killed by the state in Canada. They're trying to introduce it for mature minors. I mean, it seems like something happened in the 90s that just all of these sort of, how did you put it, the death, you know, death culture, death industries came about. And how has it taken this long for people to sort of see through what this really is? And what do you think the connection is to, like, the eugenics program? Is there one?
Well, they've to speak to the idea that there's a depopulationist agenda, that's certainly beyond debate. There are published United Nations documents. There's the Kissinger document. There's the Club of Rome. I think it's impossible to gainsay that. As to how it gets permissioned, I mean, in the 1990s, and it's still quite successful now, what you did then was that you presented these issues in a way that made people think that, in good faith, that you didn't really have a reasonable objection to it. That really, it was morally wrong to prevent people. Why would you want to prevent people having children? Why would you want to prevent them having a family? Why would you deny them that right? And so this is actually how it was permissioned. And in fact, Weltman gave a very revealing interview in about 2015, in which, I think it was in the New York Times or something, he said it was very difficult to get women to give birth to babies and then sell them to homosexual men before.
Yeah.
But he managed to go around and persuade them to do so. And he said now, he boasted, 80% of women are quite happy to do it. Now, if you fast forward to, again, the United Nations report, we're taking moral lectures from the UN today, it's how bad things are.
Right.
In July, their special rapporteur published a report, and it investigated this change. And it found that women had been coerced into this. They'd been pressured, especially in the 90s, by saying that if they didn't do this, they were bad allies. They should be allies of the rainbow people, of the LGBT people. And if they weren't, they were bad people. And that they should show solidarity and they should put their feelings aside. So you have a coercive pressure group that partners with a kind of social revolution that basically tells you you're a bad person if you don't cooperate with things that are morally dubious or even evil.
And there's just so much, the hypocrisy abounds, I guess you could say, because what this does is literally turns women into baby making machines, basically strips them of their humanity and just makes them the physical vessel by which a product is delivered. I mean, it's dehumanizing at the utmost level. And this obviously from the people on the left who will criticize, you know, people for being stay at home moms because you're just a baby, you know, a baby making machine. But it's like, no, this is actually turning them into just depersonalized, dehumanized delivery vessels for a product. That's horrifying.
Well, they don't even call them women. They never call them mothers. They call them gestational carriers.
Right.
So in all the literature, in all the marketing, women are completely erased. They're never called mothers. They have no rights. They have no rights of the children they produce. There can be clauses. They're not legally enforceable, but there can be clauses in which the clients can insist on abortion, and they have done. For example, where a girl's been produced and not a boy, or where they suspect birth defects, or there's a terrible case in America where a baby was born prematurely because the woman developed cancer. And because she had to undergo therapy, the baby had to be delivered prematurely. And the two homosexuals who had commissioned the baby didn't want a premature baby. And the upshot was that the baby died.
Well, that's a great argument for why women should be removed from the equation. And we can just have, mechanical delivery systems, because that's a reality, right? And it's actually been a reality for a while. I was reading through some of the, literature you provided, and this has been going on since the 70s, artificial wombs.
Well, again, when you say these kind of things, people naturally, when the tweet went up showing the interview that I did with Mr. Jones, people said, well, this is just nonsense. But in fact, yes, in 1978, when the first IVF baby was produced in England, there were experiments then with animal wombs, so non-human wombs, but artificial gestation. And a Catholic priest at the time, who was rather poo-pooed, Newsweek did a report on this, and they said it could never happen in America. And there was no future for this in the United States. But this priest warned, he said, I foresee a future, a terrible future, in which women's wombs are rented to produce babies that will be modified genetically in some kind of nightmare eugenics program. And they'll be reduced to commodities. And that is exactly what's happening today. At Duke University, there's a doctor who's pioneering a thing called Extend, which is said to be just for premature babies to gestate them in an artificial womb. British Medical Journal said, yes, artificial wombs are coming. Yes, they are. In America in the summer, they published a scientific research paper showing that they'd created human eggs from male skin cells.
Right.
So you will not even need a woman to produce eggs. You can create a human egg from human skin. You can fertilize it in vitro, in a glass, in a laboratory, and then you'll be able to put it in a mechanical womb and gestate it. And this is basically the automation of the production of human life.
Right, it's a brave new world.
Well, yes. And in fact, the British Medical Journal's review of this near future actually mentions this, and so do other reviews of technology, because there's several strands of research that are producing these in the near future. So the consensus is that they're coming, and that the lab production of human life is just over the horizon.
Oh, man. And it's the type of thing that's like, why do we even need to argue about this? Like, what type of person hears this and doesn't have a shiver go up their spine when they hear babies delivered in animal wombs or mechanical wombs? I mean, to me, it just seems like something that I struggle to explain why this is bad, because it seems so obvious. It seems like you should have a visceral reaction to this, but people don't. Is that just because of the marketing has been so successful and sort of concealing what this really is and putting it in nice, flowery language? Because, again, it's just, how could anybody hear, you know, a baby gestating in an animal womb and not have a visceral reaction to that? Are we the weird ones? Like, how do you argue against something that seems so fundamentally evil on the face of it? Do you know what I'm struggling with here?
Yeah, well, the thing is, I think, is that people honestly don't know. And when they hear things like this, they must think, oh, it's just some kind of spurious, baseless internet claim.
Sci-fi sort of.
But when people do hear about it and they do realize it's real, they're horrified.
Yeah.
I would like to give you a note of hope in that I've noted in trying to do this campaign to bring awareness of this and hopefully to end it, because I believe that that can be done. If enough Americans speak out about this, if the Americans stop doing this, it's finished globally, really. It
right,
has no future.
Right.
It can be stopped. Why do I think that's possible? Well, this is an issue which appeals to the basic recognition of evil and that goes far beyond any political or even religious boundaries or categories between people, atheists, believers, Christians, Catholics, left-wingers, liberals, progressives. There's a broad coalition, if you like, an international moral majority who, despite their profound differences, can all recognize that this is basically evil and it must be stopped.
Right.
Which is a tremendous note of hope.
Well, it's evil to any number. Like, it's a crime against everybody involved, almost, as far as I'm concerned, right? It depersonalizes the mother, dehumanizes the mother by turning her into a vessel for a product, turns the kid into a product, and deprives them of having a mother and a biological mother at that. I mean, these are important. These aren't just sort of optional things, right? A child responds to its mother chemically. It, you know, has needs that really a mother is best served. And sure, you know, if the mom dies or something, it doesn't mean the kid is going to die too. It's like, okay, if the mother's not available, then, you know, you can try to make up for it. But to deliberately deprive a baby of its mother, I mean, that's a crime against the child as far as I'm concerned.
Well, what you've got to look at as well is that this is basically not just the reduction of human life to a consumer product, which it is, but it also presents a kind of existential threat to the family itself.
Right.
You are taking the marital act out of the creation of human life. You are presenting a near future in which children can be produced without mothers at all. And this is where you see the terrible permissioning of what people call bioethics, because every time technology presents some new man-made horror, you get these people coming along telling you how it's fine.
Right.
And the latest trend in what they call bioethics, or the kind of morality of biology and technology, is that what's the big deal of having genetically related parents? Why do you need parents at all? We don't really need parents. We just need people who are going to nurture for and have the resources to take care of the products that they've bought. This is genuinely something that really is positioned to annihilate the very concept of the family.
Right.
So anyone who thinks that having a family is a good idea should be concerned about this.
Well, it sort of goes along. It just reminds me of some recent articles saying, basically, if you have a family, that's an unfair advantage. You know, not everybody has a family. So if you do have a family, you're sort of, you know, de facto, you're privileged over other people that don't. And that's a bad thing, obviously, because we all want. So, I mean, the demonization of the family, it reminds me, I mean, in high school reading 1984, Brave New World, there were parts of it that it was like, okay, this is just kind of silly, right? I remember the scene in 1984 where they're waving signs and then they act like, oh, the sign I made must have been made by an enemy, and they start tearing up their own signs. And I always thought, this is, you know, okay, humans can be controlled, but to a certain extent, this will never happen. Same thing with Brave New World when they talk about, you know, mother and father are bad words. And I remember reading that and thinking, okay, I mean, you know, some of this is good, but this is kind of far-fetched. it's not that far-fetched, is it? I mean, when you read Brave New World and they, you know, mother and father are considered a curse word, or, you know, people are created as clones and then deliberately disabled with alcohol, you know, in their test tube to make them more compliant. I mean, that stuff is really coming, isn't it? I mean, it if not already here.
Well, you should ask, why is that the case? And that's because the family precedes the state. It's older than the state. It's made in the image of God. It is the foundation of the nation, right? It's a competitive explanatory and institutional power to government bureaucracy, to a one-world digital tyranny, if you like. If you can undermine the family, then you can undermine one of the last bastions of human independence from tyranny or from state power,
right,
whether you like it or not. And it goes alongside the deliberate subtraction of the divine from your life, of any and of divinity, of the presence of Christ and God in the world. And it devalues your life, and it cheapens your experience, and it basically reduces you to a commodity. And so if that's the case, if that's we're just going to live in this wipe clean world where nothing has any essential value, not even human life, then really you can permission anything in that environment. Then nothing's off the table, and everything can be justified by some new bioethical jargon. And I would like to point out how insidious this trade is, because here's another shocking claim that you may hear from Katie Faust, where she's come up with the phrase that surrogacy is the paedophile's pathway to parenthood.
Right.
If you look that up on the Twitters, you'll see that she gives you five examples internationally, including in the United States, where that is strictly true. What you are doing here is you are devaluing human life to the point where people, without any background checks, can come to America and buy children for any reason they wish, and they do. And it is commonplace. And so that shocking claim turns out to be horrifyingly accurate. It is. And what is more, it is a very growing market. And that is the reason why there are no background checks on people who come to the United States to buy children, whether they are single, coupled, or indeed thrupled, whether they are homosexual or transgender individuals. And no one questions what they want the children for or what their future welfare status will be like. It's just a transaction. And that's taking place now. And that's why the business is growing here, because it's been shut down in places like Italy, France, Slovakia, Greece, Albania, Russia, Vietnam, Cambodia, India. Increasingly, around the world, governments have realised we don't want people coming here and buying children and effectively trafficking them over borders for whatever reason. I mean, you can see that this is a reality. Child trafficking in the United States under the guise of surrogacy is a reality, and you'd probably be aware of the horrendous story, and it is a shame to even mention it, of a convicted sex offender in the United States crowdfunding the purchase of a baby.
Right. It's really beyond horrifying, and it just seems like something has happened recently where all of these things, you know, luckily it seems like we're sort of clawing back from the edge, but, you know, I feel the same way about transgenderism. Just on the face of it, it's like, wait, they're buying babies, or wait, they're castrating children. Like, it's so crazy, and yet they've been able to get this across and convince people it's normal, and now it seems like after a little bit, people wake up and go, wait, what are we doing? Let's claw this back and let's stop this from happening. It's crazy that it ever happened in the first place. More with Frank Wright on the other side. Remember, you can follow him on X at Frank Wrighter, frankwriter.com as well. That's WRIGHTER, frankwriter.com. More on the other side. Harrowing topic. We have videos to show you as well. Stay with us.
Harrison, I am so excited to talk to you. I want to plug the Irish Sea Moss. It was a big game changer for me. I was having a lot of like thermoregulation issues, like morning severe chills and cold in the morning. All that stopped with the Sea Moss because it's a thyroid issue, and the Sea Moss has that iodine to heal your thyroid.
Isn't that amazing?
The Methylene Blue. Yeah, the Methylene Blue, life changing. I love it. I don't need caffeine anymore. Like, it's amazing, but I'm trying to be quick.
It's all right. Hey, when you're plugging, we got all the time in the world.
I love his supplement formulas. I am an acupuncturist. I have a master's degree in Chinese medicine, and he's got some really good formulas put together, and they work really well. I really appreciate it. I stopped taking all of my other stuff that I was taking, and I just take a lot of you guys' stuff. I mean, because I love you, and I want to support everything you guys are doing. But the formulas are good. I love the greens powder. I've tried every different type of greens powder out there. And Nothing has had as much stuff, amazing stuff packed into it, that has like a decent flavor to it. So the Optimal Human is like a daily staple.
It's
for
good,
me.
Right?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah. And, okay. And I'm not saying that because just for you guys, but seriously, I've tried so many greens powders over the years, and it really is the best.
And are we paying you, Katie? Did we pay you to call in?
I would love to work for you. I swear, Alex Jones Fisher is on, like, my mantle with all of my family pictures.
That's like, amazing.
We love Alex.
Some people call in and this person, you're paying them. But, like, no, our products really are good. People really like them. It's true.
Well, I accredited him to, like, the life-changing experience I had when I decided to leave California because I didn't want to bash Trump. And I listened to Jones when I found him. And I'm like, I got to get the hell out of here.
Right.
And so I moved back home to Ohio. And 3 months later, I met my husband. I feel like that life-changing event for me was because of listening to all the information that he gives. He's not like predicting the future. He's just giving you the information that's hard to find, where they're telling you what they're going to do.
Yeah. Well, now you have a 3-year-old kid, so your life's going great.
Yeah.
I've said it before, but with a lot of these products, like, you really don't know what it's going to do for you because you might not know that you're lacking a vitamin or lacking a mineral. And it, like, happens all the time with iodine. Iodine's one of those things where, like, as soon as you start taking it, you're like, oh, I'm not supposed to, and I'm not a doctor, it's not a medical claim, but people experience this. I've heard it from my friends where they're like, I'm not supposed to be tired all the time. I apparently just was lacking iodine. And it's like, you don't know if you're going to feel more energetic, if you're going to sleep better, if you're not going to have chills anymore. It's like people sort of go around thinking that that's the way their body is, but it's like, no, you're missing a key component. You're missing a vitamin, you're missing a mineral, and you don't even realize it until you start taking something from the Alex Jones store. So I completely understand that you start taking the Irish sea moss and suddenly something that you thought was just the way your body is. No, turns out you can fix it. You can fix these things. Again, I'm not making medical claims, but you can only find out for yourself what effects these things will have. TheAlexJonesStore.com. Thanks for the plug, Katie.
Whatever the future may hold, InfoWars will always live forever. The fights will continue. Be sure to follow us on X at RealAlexJones and at AJNLive. And now you can download the number one news app in the world. Go to AlexJonesApp.com and let the Democrat Deep State Party know that we will never be silenced.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The War Room. I'm your host, Harrison Smith. I'm joined today by Frank Wright. You can follow him, and I encourage you to do so at X, on X, at Frank Writer, and that's Frank, W-R-I-G-H-T-E-R. So, Frank Wright, Writer. I think that makes sense. We're on radio a lot, so people can't see it on screen. FrankWriter.com as well. And, you know, we were just talking about how does IVF play into this? I guess the way I'd like to approach this is, probably for most normies, if they hear surrogacy, they think, oh, that's a wonderful thing. If people can't have kids, then, you know, a woman can deliver the baby for them. I mean, how could that be bad? It's more babies. It's more life. It allows people who don't have an opportunity to be parents to actually have a child with their own genetics. I mean, how can that be a bad thing? What are the arguments that are made for this that people who haven't looked into it, they say, oh, somebody's against surrogacy? That's crazy. Why would they be against that? Well, what's the argument you would make to somebody like that who just doesn't know better?
Well, the reason why we're in this situation today is because I believe that most people are good people. And when they hear these things, they believe what they're told about them. They say, well, why would you want to deny someone the right to have a family? That's a terrible thing to say. Of course, it's just going to help people have children. Who doesn't love children?
Right.
This is the way that the industry permissions its grave moral evil. And I think that's an understatement when you find out the truth about it. Why is that the case? Because overwhelmingly, this is absolutely nothing to do with supplying children to childless couples who are infertile for no reason of their own, for no fault of their own. The growth market is in largely in LGBTQ couples, exceptionally, and also it is difficult to say how much of this market is to supply children for overseas customers, as in the two cases we saw this summer in the United States, because it is increasingly being shut down across the world, because the United Nations and the European Union have recognised that it shares vital characteristics with human and child trafficking, which in fact is what it is in many cases.
Right.
So this is the reason why it's wrong. I mean, if you don't object to children being sold to anonymous strangers across borders, then there's nothing to see here.
Right. Again, that's the thing, is it's like, when you actually understand it, how could you even argue for this? So why is America lagging behind? It probably has to do with money. So what do we have to do to get over that? What do we have to do to be like all of these other countries that have laws against us? Why don't we have it? Do we need a lobbying group? Like, what do we need to do to put a stop to this here in America?
I think it can be stopped, and it is being stopped worldwide, and there's an increasing call worldwide for it to be banned worldwide. I mean, for example, if you look at what the government of Italy have done, they've banned it in all its forms because, basically, they've recognised it is a crime to sell children. Now, bear in mind, it is fundamentally about selling children.
Right.
Now, in some countries, they'll say, oh, it's only altruistic surrogacy, meaning that you can only give gifts to the surrogate or the gestational carrier.
Oh, I see.
But in fact, that is just paying them. And the law is seldom enforced. So basically, wherever it's permitted, it is a commercial exchange to purchase a young life. And it usually doesn't satisfy the presumed characteristics on which the surrogacy agencies trade. It's usually not a case of a poor man and a poor woman who can't have children of their own. It's usually very little to do with that. And I'll tell you how insidious it is. In somewhere like the United Kingdom or Australia, where you are not allowed to pay directly, you're not allowed to do what's called commercial surrogacy. You've got to pretend and indirectly pay them by buying them expensive gifts and so on. Or you can travel abroad and buy a baby in the United States. There's nothing wrong with that, apparently. But they're going to try, the industry's trying to get legal permission for commercial surrogacy. And the way they're doing this is they came up with a new phrase called socially infertile people. Now, don't you feel sorry for people who are socially infertile? Now, I'm going to give you a guess. Your starter for 10 is, what do you think they really mean when they talk about people who are socially infertile?
Well, yeah, a couple options. I doubt they're advocating for the incels. I doubt they're advocating for the involuntary celibate. So I'm going to go with the rainbow people. Is that?
Yes, it is. Yeah. How did you guess? No, it's
choosing lifestyles that.
It's not about providing an opportunity for children for people who are basically infertile heterosexual couples. It's about including in that definition basically men.
Right.
Men who are partnered with men or men who dress up as women. And so that's what this situation is. And the reason why that's taking place, this is not propaganda, is because that section of society typically has a lot of money to spend because they don't have children.
Right.
And therefore they have the kind of money to spend, which in the United States can be around $200,000 per child. Very lucrative industry. To buy babies. Now, if you are a government and you want to make more revenue, this is a very lucrative industry with very little input and has very little oversight. The overheads are very low. Profit margins are very high. It looks very progressive. And you can tell people who don't really understand it that all you're doing is providing a pathway to parenthood for people who are otherwise denied it for socially infertile reasons.
Socially infertile. It's the jargon, isn't it? I mean, they're so good with words, they can come up with something like socially infertile, and people would just accept it and just go, oh, yeah, that makes sense. They're infertile, but because of the choice. I mean, it's jargon.
Really, in all honesty, you should show them a picture of Bruce Jenner whenever you use that.
Right. That's what you mean by socially infertile.
Yes.
But it really is about manipulation of language, isn't it? I think back to when they say gender-affirming care.
Oh, dear.
Right?
Oh, dear.
But it's very sophisticated. It's very sort of... It's hard to argue against a phrase like that. It's gender-affirming care. What they mean is castration. But when you call it for abortion, they'll say women's health care. Actually, now they say abortion care, right? If you add the word care on it, suddenly it's not an abortion. I mean, it's all about the words, isn't it? How do they use words, and why is that such a successful strategy for them?
Well, because if you look at how government was developed in the liberal democratic system, which was invented in the 1920s, it was basically replaced the policeman's baton with a form of propaganda. Mm. The people who wrote that about propaganda, people like Walter Lippmann and Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays.
Right.
Edward Bernays said things like marketing, public relations, advertising, propaganda, they're all the same thing. He said it was called applied psychoanalysis. Now, what does that mean? It means you use fancy words that appeal to people's feelings, that make them feel good when they imagine or say those words, and then you attach them to symbols or industries or businesses or political policies. And so when people say or imagine these things, they feel good about themselves, even if that thing, especially if that thing, is not actually good at all, especially when it's very bad or evil. So you apply these ideas to these things. You say, pardon me, this is gender-affirming care, or you've got the right to die. Mm. Who would deny you the right to die?
Right.
That's another death industry. You know, if you're saying to people, well, look, we're going to prescribe suicide as a form of health care, people would be outraged. But if you repackage it as the right to die, if you repackage it as access to parenthood for the socially infertile, and that sounds like a good thing to support. And you say, you would feel bad for saying no to it. So, yes, it is intentionally manipulative, but it's the basis of marketing. And the 20th century was about selling you a god. In fact, selling you a god, any god, but actually God himself.
Right.
So you come to believe in these things, these progressive ideas, with you come to infuse them with a religious fervour, whether it's been deliberately subtracted from Christ and re-injected into things like the rainbow flag or the net zero agenda or open borders or all the progressive policies of social revolution that all seem to be destructive in some way, destructive to human dignity, to the family, to the nation, and ultimately to your sanity. And when you are in that state of vulnerability, when everything has been confused and destroyed, this is the opportunity for where, well, look, we can provide you with some order. We can provide you with meaning. We can provide you with slogans for basically marketed evil that will give you a momentary sense of satisfaction.
Mm.
And then you'll be ever more accepting of these things because you're made desperate because of everything that's been subtracted from your life.
Right.
You know, I think we live in one of the things about the liberal global system that people overlook is that it intentionally was designed to replace everything with itself, everything past, present and future, with itself. And it's partnered with a form of consumer nihilism. So when you look at it, you might not really understand the magnitude of what it means to reduce human life to a product, but think about it. Think about how much of the stuff on the supermarket shelves is just trash, toxic trash, not even food. Think about human life being placed upon that shelf. There's no category anymore between the things that you buy and dispose of when you're finished.
Right.
And babies, and the elderly, and us. And once you've achieved that, then there's really no limit to what you can do in terms of human degradation. And it's interesting you mentioned the transgender movement because there's been those two surveys that showed that the trans wave has peaked.
Right.
And there's been a dramatic fall off in younger people identifying as gender flux and so on. And these are adjacent or contiguous industries. They are transhuman. It was
right.
A woman called Bilek who, it was a feminist. Like, there's a lot of feminists have pioneered work, campaigning, really successful work against the trans wave, World War T, and against this, against surrogacy. It's been feminists like Bilek who wrote a book called Transsexual, Transgender, Transhuman.
Mm.
And it's a collection of essays that came out a couple of years ago, and she was extremely severely attacked for these things, vehemently. The industry mobilized against her, but she was correct in saying that it is a transhuman cult masquerading as a civil rights movement.
Mm.
So there again you see the insidious packaging of something profoundly dubious and even evil.
Yeah.
Something overtly satanic in many cases, but it's presented as an aspirational, liberationist movement of human rights. And so therefore you're a bad person if you oppose the progress of evil.
Right. And there's so many things like that. You know, in Canada they call the assisted suicide medical assistance in dying, or you can even think of social things like Black Lives Matter, where Who would say Black Lives don't matter? You would never. How dare you oppose that? So by sloganeering in this, or Antifa, that's the latest one, right? Oh, if you're against Antifa, that means you're a fascist. You love fascists. I mean, it's word games people play, and it's strange more people can't see through it because it seems so blatant, especially when they do things like abortion care or gender affirming care. And it's like they're just disguising the reality. And that's really what it is, isn't it? There's a fight against the real and the delusions of these people who really see themselves as God. And you know, that idea of transhumanism has definitely percolated, or I don't know if that's the right word, but maybe dripped down to the lower levels. I was talking to somebody and about transgenderism, and they said, well, you know, we're all transitioning into gods. You know, they're like, what, humanity itself is transitioning into a new thing. So this mindset has already been, you know, inculcated into people's minds, even if they're not at the high level involved in sort of the satanic occultish stuff. There are people on the ground that are going along with this and think it's a good thing.
Well, yeah, you are encouraged generally by this kind of mass culture to be trans-sane in every right. area of your life, right? And apparently, if you are visibly sane, if you're reliably sane, you're a balanced, sane, decent human being, they call you a nutter.
Yeah.
So you're a madman.
Yeah.
Now, how have we got here? A man that I mentioned to you just now, Walter Lippmann, who effectively helped to design the liberal democratic system. He was a founding member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Mm. He wrote a book called Public Relations, and he said in a 1919 essay in The Atlantic that the basic problem of democracy was that people were apt to think what they thought about the world,
right.
and we couldn't have that. So we have to create public opinion. And what that really means is the manufacture of mass belief. And he said, in order to manufacture consent, it was he who came up with that phrase,
right.
All you had to do was create a pseudo-environment in people's minds. Through the uses of images and mass media and radio and advertising, you would present a false picture of the world to people, and you can manipulate that because you're in charge of the cultural production of the images in people's heads.
Right.
And so for a century, for 100 years, people in the West have been saturated with cultural propaganda, which is basically everything that you consume in your media, your news, your thought leaders, your art, your popular music, your entertainment, is in some dimension a form of propaganda for the liberal system. And it's intentionally designed to replace Christ at the center of Christianity and to supply political beliefs there instead. And this is the reason why people cop for it, because that technique was invented 100 years ago, but it's been systematically and continually refined ever since.
And it's deployed deliberately in a subtle way, so that you don't notice it, right? Because I remember being a kid and seeing, you know, I was watching some show and there's a woman, she's, you know, they say, oh, won't you have a kid? And she says, oh, well, like, I'd want a parasite, you know, wriggling its way out from between my legs. And it's like, what a disgusting way to talk about it. But this was just a sitcom on, you know, ABC or whatever, but it's planting in your mind, you know, natural birth is disgusting. It's gross. It's unnatural. It's all sort of in the same line, and it's bizarre because you do have this, like, they're depopulating the earth, but then they're using this weird, you know, surrogacy program where they're creating life. So that would seem contradictory, but it's all really in the same movement. And so it's not so much about hating and wanting to destroy humans outright. It's wanting to, in this weird, almost inverted way, elevate humanity above nature, but it's kind of hard. It's just hard for me to kind of contend with because it's just so unnatural, and they want to elevate people, but the way they do that is by dragging us down into the mud, and they want to kill everybody, and they think it, you know, natural birth is disgusting, but then they're advocating for surrogacy. So it's just really about just like disconnecting humanity with reality in a fundamental way. That again, it's hard for me to enunciate because it seems like something you have to either understand. You either understand it or you don't. You either get how bizarre and unnatural and perverted this all is, or you're just not paying attention. So again, you know, just getting back to the question at the beginning of this, for the people that again just go, these people, they just don't like gay people. That's why they must be bigots, you know, for thinking this. What is your like 10-second pitch? Just go, here's what you don't know about surrogacy. What are some of the like really crazy facts that people, once they hear it, you know, really can't go along with this?
Well, really, I just ask you to bear in mind one sentence from the UN report. The sale of children is a crime. Apart from that, especially given what we said about the technique of control of the 20th century, be very, very suspicious when people tell you that something is good. Because the complexity of this situation can be collapsed in a simple observation. Everything that they tell you is good for you is actually bad.
Right.
And everything that's really, really bad, they tell you is good. You can call that moral inversion, but that is a simple guide to that. So when you see a highly sophisticated marketing campaign that presents something in soft focus, aspirational tones, and it's a wonderful, uplifting message for humanity, This is when you should start to think there's a smell of sulfur in the room, right, and listen carefully for the echoing laughter of Satan.
Right, absolutely. And you have so much information about this and documentation about this that again, if people are interested and actually want to find out, if they want to try to disprove Mr. Wright here, they're welcome to go look at the data. And some of this is wild. This chart here from this document package, which I assume a lot of this can be found at your Substack, which again is frankwriter.com, and that goes to your Substack, right? Frankwriter.com. So explain this chart to us. This is surrogacy market by type, 2021. Is this $2 trillion USD? I mean, that seems insane, but is that how?
Oh no. The market by type to 2034, USD billion would be the worldwide market is estimated to go between 200 and around, you know, $230 billion by 2034, right? So enormous growth. And if you look at the shading on these bars, you can see there's a tiny little blue line at the top.
Right.
That tiny little blue line is the number of babies, surrogate babies, delivered by what you would call natural surrogacy. But the overwhelming volume of surrogate babies are delivered by IVF, which is where an embryo is created outside the body of the surrogate, and the woman carrying it, which they never call a mother, which is disgraceful,
right,
has no genetic relation to the baby at all.
Right. So natural surrogacy, which you almost can't even tell just because our printer was running out of ink or something, but there's just a little sliver at the very top, and so that would be somebody who is carrying somebody else's baby but was naturally gestated, naturally conceived inside the body rather than IVF. The crossover of IVF is a little bit weird here because I have to admit I'm a fan of IVF. I like IVF because I know most of my friends and, you know, just as a consequence of the natural world could not conceive naturally, and a lot of them had to do IVF, and I have trouble looking at their children and saying, you know, this is evil. But when IVF is being used this way, I mean, that's horrifying. How does IVF interact with this topic? Because again, a lot of people against it. Obviously, if it's used this way, it's horrible. But I think it's in a lot of ways kind of a miracle technology. How does that play with this? Does the political nature of IVF, you know, interact with this? Give it protection or make it more difficult? How does IVF interact with this?
The reason the IVF market is even bigger than the surrogacy market. It is enormously valuable market. Billions and billions of dollars. Now, you can look into why that's been the case. Why are so many people waiting later in life to have children so they're infertile and so they have to revert to that? Because basically the Western economy has made it practically impossible for you to afford to have a family.
Right.
There are policies like such as in Hungary, it's been long established, or recently in Poland, where if you have more than two children, you will get a complete income tax rebate. You pay no income tax.
Right.
They will actually prohibit the lobbying and permissioning of LGBTQ alternative or novel family structures. And they'll favour what we are regrettably compelled to call the traditional family instead. Now, you can change policy to make it more possible for people to have children, but for it not to be an impossible dream like it is for many young Americans to own a home to raise them in. And you can also look at, like, what are the environmental factors that cause infertility.
Right.
Perhaps we shouldn't be drinking polluted water and eating toxic trash as well.
Right.
Perhaps we should be looking at that instead of an industry that is itself, as a Catholic, for me, is a grave insult to human life, because most people don't know that it destroys more human lives, perhaps twice as many every year, as abortion.
Mm.
Because for every fertilized embryo, which is the goal of IVF, you may create up to 11 or 12 of them, most of which are just flushed down the toilet, thrown in the bin.
Right.
Or in some cases, they're frozen. And now you have bioethicists telling you that, oh, no, we shouldn't waste them. Why don't we just sell them to someone else? And, of course, why not? Because you've turned human life into a lab-grown commodity.
Right.
And then that has a market value. And, again, the overheads are very good because all you need is a fridge and a distribution system. And then you can make a lot of money, perhaps $200,000, from selling a human life.
Right. Well, and we know that, you know, abortion, one of the reasons they're pushing for later and later abortions is because they sell the body parts of the babies they abort. So the more developed it is, the more valuable it is. It's, you know, the disgusting hidden reason why they, you know, always clamor for later and later abortions up to 9 months, because it's actually more valuable to sell the child that way. So I guess with IVF, the way you're describing it, it's almost like it's like you're putting a Band-Aid on a cancer, right? The cancer is the poisons and the economic situation and just the lack of fertility overall. Instead of solving that problem at its root, we're trying to cover up the effects of the problem, which is really just creating more problems.
How do we get to the point, right? How do you call it a successful, thriving democracy or a nation to be proud of, where it is an impossible dream for young people in Britain and America to think of starting a family and having a home of their own to live in them? You know, why? How did we get to this point? How can this be possible? This, a couple of generations ago, some people point out that look at Homer Simpson. He didn't even go to college, and look how many kids he's got on the sides of his house.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
that was real.
Looks like another planet.
Right.
You know, it's ridiculous. You know, the American dream now is living in your mother's basement.
Right.
And going mad on the internet.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And it's happened very quickly, and they tell you not to question it, and it seems like the purpose of a state. I mean, that's the fundamental thing, right? You want to be able to create, and you know, when you say a traditional family structure. That's almost a misnomer, isn't it? Because the traditions that we stick to aren't just some sort of, superstition, you know, that we're just sticking to because we've been brainwashed into a cult. This is the best way to do things. It's a tradition because it's been through trial and error. We've established a mother and a father being married for life and raising their own children in their own home. That is the ideal condition for raising happy, healthy, successful humans. And that's what's being destroyed because they just claim, this is all just, you know, sort of bigoted and prejudiced and superstitious. But no, it's a tradition because through trial and error, humanity discovered this is the greatest way to do things. And that's what they don't want you to know.
If you read, and I suggest you read a little bit of it, a 1930s book by Wilhelm Reich, who was a psychoanalyst in the Sigmund Freud school. It's called The Mass Psychology of Fascism. Briefly, he diagnoses fascism as being produced in traditional families.
Right.
So not what we would call families or normal families. But to him, this is a factory of little fascists. And the cure, he said, was sexualizing mothers and children, sexualizing women and children to liberate them from family ties. And he says it 7 times in the book, sexually liberate children.
Well, and that's something I always point out about the Kindler experiment, which I know you and Alex talked about, which was in Germany where they gave children to pedophiles. And you ask, why would they do that? And the reason was because the guy who put on the study was an anti-fascist. His father was a Nazi. He hated his father. And he connected sort of sexual purity and moral, you know, righteousness as a pathway to fascism. So it was actually they carried out that experiment where they gave children to pedophiles to defeat fascism.
But you can see that the construct of fascism that's being used here is basically a description of normal family life. I think it's important to stress that point. That a man who is clearly a deranged sexual pervert is diagnosing normal life as a pathological condition that must be wiped out by making children and women sexually immoral.
Yep.
This is another dimension of the war on the family.
Absolutely. Wow, we could go on and on forever. Thank you so much for being with us. Frank Wright, everybody, frankwriter.com.
We'll join our regularly scheduled program after these messages.
I didn't know he was taking our ultramethylene blue. So I said, with all our guests, we asked him to take it, and you just gave me your brief testimony. So I would look, because, I mean, this isn't BS. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. takes it. It's good for your cells. If you're on SSRIs, you can't take it. It's very serious. We have the strongest, and it funds this operation. You want to get it at thealexshowstore.com. Medical grade, USP grade, the best. Ultramethylene blue. So you sort of give me your testimony saying you love it. I said, hold on. I don't want to know. I want you to tell people on air, William, so when did you get it? What was the effect?
So I've been a health nut, people call me, all my life.
Well, you look super young for your age. So.
And so I thank God that I've been healthy. And when I take most supplements, a lot of people say, you'll feel, you know, this big surge. And normally I don't. I just think, okay, I'm doing something right for my body and for my brain. And with methylene blue, I do notice that it does seem to give me more mental energy. It helps me I keep a lot of late hours. I'm talking to people over in Europe or over in other continents. And so my biorhythms get all messed up. And so it really helps me with my sleep. And
well, I'll be honest, though, because you're saying your doctors, others told you to do it, just like mine did 6 years ago. I got it, USP, didn't really have the effect. My wife liked it, so she's been on it. We tried different brands. This one, I'm not trying to differentiate, it's just true. It's been way stronger for me. If you do have other brands you took that are as good or better, I want to know, because if there's something better, we'll go with them.
I haven't found anything better.
Now, back to our program.
You guys remember when Cobra took over television in G.I. Joe episode The Wrong Stuff? Roadblock tries to tune into the news, but every channel has been replaced by Cobra Television Network.
This is the Cobra Television Network.
The first show has a very clear message to the viewer.
Don't trust anybody. I could be your neighbor.
The next show is Cobra's ripoff of the A-Team.
Sense the C-Team, starring Mr. C.
I pity the fool that doesn't join Cobra. I pity him.
It's a joke, right? A videotape.
No siree, Bob, Duke. That's real TV.
All the channels are like that.
Next, the Joes watch a televised interview with Cobra Commander.
So, when did you first discover you wanted to rule the world?
I was 6 when I realized I could run society better than the morons who were in charge.
That old, huh?
Slow learner, I guess.
This new era in television is only the beginning! Cobra!
We also see a Cobra ripoff of King Kong with another explicit message for the viewer.
You can never win if your enemy is bigger and stronger than you.
Cobra Commander explains how he altered the ending of the movie and how he will use the medium of television for propaganda.
You changed the ending?
Yes, to promote Cobra's social philosophy.
Baroness is skeptical about how this is possible.
How was this accomplished?
Computers, of course. Voice and picture synthesis.
Amazing.
Cobra plans to hide from the Joes and beam their programs to their satellites to avoid interference.
Because G.I. Joe will never find us here, and we can beam our programs to our satellite with no interference.
Cobra Commander then explains how television is the ultimate weapon of control. Because people trust it?
I would feel more secure if the Joe's activities were under control.
You lack imagination, Destro. We possess the ultimate weapon of control. People trust television. It's their friend. They believe what television tells them about the news, the weather, or G.I. Joe. Don't you see? We control the creation of truth.
We see a Cobra-produced children's show that promotes conformity.
Oh, gee, likeables. Nobody likes me.
That's because you're different, Perpy. Only when everybody looks alike and acts alike
and thinks alike
and never ever gets angry
can we achieve world peace.
Tune in next week for more pro-social fun with The Likeables.
Then Cobra Commander sings and dances after his latest plan is going well.
It's mine, you know. Totally mine.
Cobra Commander asks the viewers for donations and even lists their P.O. box.
But G.I. Joe may try again to deprive you of your viewing pleasure. We have fortified our defenses, but the price of vigilance is high. Help keep Cobra on the air by sending a generous contribution to this address.
Cobra Commander interrupts a football game to advertise Cobra and G.I. Joe's upcoming battle in space.
Put me back on the air immediately!
And Farley's headed for the end zone!
Hello, sports fans! You're about to witness some real excitement! Live and direct from space, a game of life and death between G.I. Joe and Cobra!
At the end of the episode, Mr. C shows up and asks G.I. Joe for a job.
It's what I can do for you. I'm mean, I'm bad, and I'm out of work. You got any openings in G.I. Joe?
Numerous plot devices from this episode arguably aged well, such as using computer and television for propaganda, the concept of voice and picture synthesis, using satellites to broadcast content, and crowdfunding Cobra TV. What do you guys think?
Whatever the future may hold, InfoWars will always live forever. The fight will continue. Be sure to follow us on X at RealAlexJones and at AJNLive. And now you can download the number one news app in the world. Go to AlexJonesApp.com and let the Democrat Deep State Party know that we will never be silenced.
was hoping you had some of the Alex Jones ones. How is Alex?
He's great. He lost a lot of weight.
I saw he's getting like, yeah, he's ready for the next
My friend
big...
Sean Johnson's training him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he gets up every morning. He works out for hours. He's lost, I think he's lost 70 pounds at this point. Hmm. He looks fantastic, man.
Yeah.
He looks fantastic. He looks like he's 20 years younger. People think, because this is really funny, because, you know, his whole business is conspiracy theories. Conspiracy that Alex has been replaced.
Yeah, yeah.
But listen, folks, that's real Alex. I've watched every step of the way, and my friend trains him. So I can tell you for a fact, that is the real Alex Jones. Quit drinking, quit eating bad food. He's eating healthy food now. He works out every day. It's like no Ozempic, no bullshit, no shortcuts. He did it the right way. Looks great.
You find it all at thealexjonesshow.com, and it funds the most hardcore patriot organization worldwide, absolutely devastating the globalists in our peaceful information war.
Holy shit, he was right about every step of the way.
Peeling back the layers of the day's events to reveal the core truth. War Room with Harrison Smith.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The War Room. I'm your host, Harrison Smith. Guest in studio, Jay Dyer. He's an author, comedian, TV presenter known for his deep analysis of Hollywood geopolitics and culture. Of course, you all know that already. If you don't know it, you can go to jaysanalysis.com. That's jaysanalysis.com. He's on YouTube at Jay Dyer, and he's on X at J_D007. D007. And you got to get the whole name. I just tried to tag you, Jay, in a post, and I had to type out all the way to J_D0, and then it went, oh, this is the guy you mean. Oh. So you're still shadow banned to some degree, aren't you?
Probably. I mean, there was at one point where it was like straight up shadow banned. You couldn't find me at all.
Yeah.
And then it kind of went away after like a week or two. So,
well, you're there now. And I was really enjoying, you know, you and Alex's conversation, because it was just sort of a freewheeling, you know, discussion about all sorts of stuff. And I thought one of the interesting things y'all touched on is the persistence of like Scottish people in rebellious activity, mm-hmm. and how it just seems to be a part of the nature of Scottish people. And, you know, you look at the Texas Revolution, the American Revolution, Canada was mostly settled by Scots. Mm-hmm. There's something about this, the Celtic strain that sort of bucks under restrictions. What do you draw from that, and what do you think the importance of that is, and just the way things unfold across the world?
Well, we're not inbred, so it doesn't slow us down with slow boy IQ. So some groups do that. Some Middle Eastern groups do that, and that kind of slows down things. But, you know, some of the elite writings, there's one I didn't bring with me, which is Charles Galton Darwin's book, I forget the title, Next Million Years. Mm-hmm. And in that one, he talks about the genetic heritage of European peoples, of British Isle peoples, Scottish peoples, Irish people, et cetera. And in that, he says that these people are probably the toughest to control, because they kind of just have, maybe through the environment, you know, living in those climates, that kind of, you know, epigenetically kind of, you know, through a microevolution way, you could say, prepared them for very difficult scenarios and a lot of warfare and that kind of stuff. So I think we're a tough people. You can see, like, I still got the red hair here. We're a tough people. Some people have even speculate there's this gene that's responsible for that kind of like both madness and like genius.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Scottish people, there's a name for it. I forget the name of that gene, but yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating theory. But regardless, like, many of these texts say explicitly that Western white European peoples and their religion have to be subverted, and that's what we're undergoing right now.
Yeah, and this is an established fact. I mean, this goes back, you can read, you know, Julius Caesar's writings, and, you know, he had a lot of trouble with the Germans because they have this proclivity to, you know, you can't just order them to do something. I remember reading a Roman general at some point, and he, you know, the Romans, you just say, go do this, and they go do it. The Germans, you had to explain why they're doing it. You had to explain what they're going to get for doing it. They weren't just going to follow orders outright. And then, of course, Julius Caesar obviously failed to conquer Britain, and they never really got all the way up to Scotland. They ended up just building, you know, Hadrian's Wall after a couple hundred years of trying. But the reason was because Britain was this generator of conflict against the Romans, right? It was this sort of, you know, I think about it like a video game where you've got all the monsters coming out of the doorway, and you have to go destroy the doorway, or else the monsters are going to keep coming. So, you know, and they would say, you know, people would be sent to Britain to study, you know, under these occult practices, in the same way that, you know, a lawyer might be sent to Rhodes to become a scholar. So, you know, Britain was this headquarters of sort of this Celtic religion that constantly was rebelling against Rome. And so they were like, we're never going to have peace until we destroy the source. And I don't think they ever got to the source.
Yeah, well, they're trying that now, right? So the source is, you know, I believe in the soul of a people. If you read, you know, somebody like Oswald Spengler, who was very critical of Hitler, very critical of the Reich, and was eventually, I think he had to leave Germany because he thought Hitler was a tiny, tiny little man. But he's you know, considered a right winger and considered kind of one of those historicist thinkers that classifies everything in terms of like cycles, and the Western peoples, he said, would be subverted by the other nations taking over their technology. In other words, the liberal socialist ethos of liberal Christianity would be the undoing of the Western peoples, and that would allow the other people groups that aren't necessarily enemies, but that would be imported to kind of take over. And he said this would be the fate, although he was not for it. The Tavistock Institute actually studied Spengler's Decline of the West to figure out how to weaponize it.
Right.
Other texts talk about weaponizing this kind of stuff too. Tavistock text, this text right here talks about similar ideas, but basically you have to destroy the individual idea of sovereignty and of building your own, you know, life and family and business. All that has to be destroyed to put you into a collectivist mindset. And one of the key ways that we don't talk about a lot is just guilt, like using guilt, saying that all you're guilty for your ancestors' colonialism. There's a great chapter in here that's it's kind of funny. Like Margaret Mead, who's kind of a fraud, Margaret Mead says, oh, you gave people, you know, clothing and they couldn't wear grass skirts anymore. So you made them want stuff.
Right.
That's why, it's what she says, like the stupidest argument. Only academics could believe an argument that retarded, right?
Right.
But that's why colonialism is bad. So yeah, you might have raised everybody's living standards and saved lives with medicine, but you're bad because they have, you don't have grass skirts anymore.
Right.
So greed is somehow bound up with the idea of raising people groups. And I'm pro colonialism. I think nobody should feel guilt for their ancestors bringing, you know, civilization. Think about, you know, speaking of Mel Gibson, Apocalypto. That's the whole point of Apocalypto is, you know, don't you think those guys were happy when they saw the Spanish coming and like they're running from this giant human sacrifice cult, right?
Yeah.
They see like the Spanish coming. It's like, oh, maybe they'll help us.
Yeah. It's fascinating. And, you know, obviously the British were just exceptional when it came to colonialism, and just you see how widespread the sort of British diaspora went. And you know, I guess, you know, the world wars is the obvious answer, but like, how did they lose it? How did it go so wrong so fast? Because when you had from Australia to South Africa to America, I mean, this was an Anglo world for a while, and there were some very good consequences from that. But then ever since World War II, it's just like it hasn't just collapsed. It's gone the other way. It's like now, you know, the white people are just being driven out of everywhere, including their own homelands. Like, how did it go so wrong so fast?
Even though, like, we're supposedly colonialists, is not our land, but then it's wrong if we don't want other people coming to colonize our
right.
land. So it makes no sense. Nothing on the left makes any sense. That's on purpose, by the way. But one of the books I've been covering for many years is Johann Rathier's amazing book, The Milner-Fabian Conspiracy. It's a geopolitical, historical espionage text. It's not really a conspiracy text. He just kind of goes from a lot of the same books. And there's a great chapter that hits on what you're talking about the OSS and CIA psychological warfare and mind control operations that many people don't know about that we, the U.S., did against Germans. So, and I'm not, again, I'm very conspiratorial when it comes to the narrative of World War II. I think that Hitler played a role in helping to create the dialectic that would lead to the establishment of the nation state of Israel. You couldn't have today's, you know, 1948 recognition without what Hitler did. So that's a different topic. But there's a chapter where it says that the OSS really went deep into studying the German psyche. And again, I'm not backing up Hitler. I'm against Hitler. I think he was a bad guy. He was an antichrist in the Orthodox Christian perspective. But it's not accidental that after World War II, the OSS set up all of these propaganda operations in Germany to make sure that Germans would never tap into their native strength, the soul of that people, to become an engineering powerhouse like they were before World War II. So they actually psyoped them into like being farmers and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of weird.
Yeah, and I was
Not that it's wrong to be a farmer, but they just didn't want him to be warlike.
Well, they didn't want him to reach their potential be designers of their own destiny. And, you know, I was watching some YouTube drama slop yesterday, and part of it was H3H3. They had a German guy, and the German guy was going, you know, we've studied our history and we know how evil we are. And so Americans are not good at studying the history. And I just kept thinking, like, you haven't studied your history. You've been subject to a propaganda program that's going on 70 years that's convinced you to demonize your own people. And it's sad to see Germans pick up that mantle and, like, demonize themselves and think that they're doing a good thing. It's really a brutal way to treat somebody. And yeah.
Guilt. I mean, like this book talks about that they've studied the psychology of guilt manipulation, and that's what a big part of that is. So if you can manipulate an entire continent of people through phony faux guilt narratives, and that's really what all the social engineering is all about, is creating those narratives.
Yeah. And, it is connected to, the wider geopolitical goals of the people manipulating even figures like Hitler into serving their ends. And I thought that was another fascinating thing that you touched on with Alex, is sort of how the Rothschilds were involved in the settlement of Israel 100 years before the 1948 declaration. So talk a little bit about that, because that's something I think people don't understand enough, is that, you know, the Rothschilds are really central to the whole conspiracy, the whole global conspiracy, all really, it goes back farther, obviously, but mm-hmm. like starting with, that first Rothschild, with the five sons and the different, I mean, you talk about intelligence agencies, you talk about the control of these central banks. It all goes back to this one family in Germany in like the 1600s.
Well, they were smart enough to really send out the family emissaries to the European countries to basically set up banks. And there's a great chapter in Quigley's Tragedy and Hope that's about the French banking system, the Paribas system, which was dominated and run by the Rothschilds. So eventually, and it wasn't all Rothschilds, there was also Protestant and Catholic banking as well. But eventually they came to dominate and they set up this Paribas banking system. But to fast forward up to the time of the late 1800s, actually mid-1800s, in the 1860s, all the way into the 1890s, the nation state of Israel was being planned.
Right.
They didn't know if they would eventually get a full-on nation state. But Edmund Rothschild said, well, I'm going to start buying tracts of land. And he became an anonymous benefactor. He went under a code name, Nadav Heyuda. And so they didn't know who this person was. It was buying all this land. They were talking to a Turkish sultan who was happy to sell it.
Right. They're sort of absentee landowners that would live in Istanbul and owned tracts of land in Palestine where they'd get tax revenue, but it was a pittance. And so, you know, when Rothschild comes along and goes, hey, I'll give you an exorbitant amount of money, of course they're going to say yes.
And according to the biographer here, who's, you know, not partisan, it's an official kind of biography. I mean, he doesn't put it like they really that the Rothschilds themselves thought it would be super political. Supposedly, he just wanted a bunch of religious sites that Jews could go and be pilgrims to.
Okay.
But then he meets with Theodor Herzl. He meets with other characters involved in political Zionism, and they try to talk him into it. Initially, supposedly, they weren't that interested in getting political because they were actually pretty European, and they thought, this is going to damage our name in Europe if we are seen as a sort of hyper-political, involved in the British Imperial project of setting up this nation. So they didn't immediately get that, but eventually they came around to it, and they did put money into the settlement of Palestine, massive amounts of money into the 1930s. This is after Balfour Declaration. At that time, the first donation, I think 1931, they gave $40,000 to Heim Weizmann and the project. They tried to buy the Wailing Wall, and they wanted to try to find the Ark of the Covenant and all this kind of stuff. But, for whatever reason, the Grand Rabbi of Israel at that time actually told, Edmund that he couldn't buy the Wailing Wall. So I don't know what the reason for that. The biography doesn't say, but, after this time though, they do begin gradually to buy more and more and more. And then eventually, I think my theory is that they realized that they were not going to get the recognition of the nation state of Israel until there was some event that would occur that forced remigration. And that came in waves of tens of thousands. Eventually they got 500,000, 600,000 Jews into Israel, after, the 1930s and 40s. But the tiny mustache man event helped to do that. And after World War II, it's because of World War II that 1948 recognize it, the UN recognizes Israel as because of, you know, World War II. So when you look at Quigley from that vantage point and you see him talking about the money that was put into, funding him, aiding him, bringing him to power, giving him, as we said, like there's a whole chapter in Quigley on Tragedy and Hope on the dual strategy. Mm. And the dual strategy is that the British power structure was telling Hitler the whole time, we will secretly support you. We're not going to attack you. Go into Poland, go into Czechoslovakia, take the money, take whatever, take the loot. We're behind you, but we're going to have to tell the public that we're against you.
Right.
And after all this, they stabbed him in the back. They didn't keep supporting him. Then we got World War II. And why would we want World War II? Well, World War I was engineered, according to Quigley, by the same elite families and power structure to get the League of Nations.
Right.
The League of Nations didn't have any teeth. America opposed it. So, well, let's have a bigger war with a more villainous figure.
Right.
Then we'll have what we want, which wasn't just the nation state of Israel. That's one piece of an overall larger picture, which is, I think, what changing images of man is about. And, like, here's the thing. Everybody says, well, what is it, the Jews, or is it these people who are like theosophists, socialists? These projects work together because the socialist Zionist project, because Zionism is all socialism.
Right.
Especially with Hess and Herzl and these characters. It's the same socialism as these people.
Right.
So when you read these, when you read like Moses Hess, he's not a theist in the way that you think of like a personal God external to you. He explicitly says, I believe in Hegel, process theology, pantheism, Spinoza. Spinoza was a Jewish pantheist. He says, that's what our project is. God is the dialectic of everything happening in history. That's God. Dialectical process. So he thinks that the dialectical process is moving man towards, in Hess's view, the establishment of a nation state that would be the beacon for world socialism.
Right.
Now, not everybody has that same idea, right? The theosophists, they didn't really like the Judaic idea of it. They said, no, maybe it'll be Tiny Mustache Man. Maybe that kind of an idea will set up a socialist world government, fascist world government, whatever. But it ended up being none of those, and it went, and it's basically the Fabian socialist model, which blends perfectly with the Zionist model. It's the same stuff.
Right. And of course, a lot of the early settlers of the kibbutzes were socialists who had been driven out of the Pale of Settlement by the pogroms, and then they went and settled. And once the Tsar was overthrown, they took what they'd learned and went up and helped to establish the Bolshevik, you know, government, the communist government, you know, through taking sort of the theories of Marx that they had been espousing previously. They put them into action in the kibbutzes and sort of learned how politically they could work out. Explain what you mean by Israel being just part of a much larger plan. Cause I think that's where people get stuck. They see Israel doing a lot of stuff, the Greater Israel Project, all that stuff. I always try to remind them that's just one part. And tell me if I'm wrong. My assumption is that they want Israel and specifically Jerusalem to be the capital of the global government.
Yeah.
It will be sort of inviolable. I always say globalism is sort of the marriage of communism and Zionism, where you have the nation state that's inviolable in Israel, but everywhere else is deracinated and the borders are empty. Is that what you mean when you say it's part of a larger project?
Yeah, I think that there's certain people like Moses Hess or a Herzl that would think that we'll set up a nation state. We will have the real beacon of world socialism that will save the world. And they actually speak of it in salvific ways. Mm. So like when they read Isaiah 53, the suffering servant, they say, oh, that's not really about some Messiah or, you know, some person. It's about the Jewish people and the eventual establishment of this nation state that will be the salvation.
Mm.
So they internalize the messianic prophecies. Not all of them. I'm just saying some. So I think for somebody like Moses Hess or somebody like that, or some of the Zionist ideologues, they believe in a political salvific ideology, which is very close to what we would say is kind of an Antichrist ideology, because that's who would accept the Antichrist.
Right.
Is somebody who believes that kind of an ideology. But I think other globalists that are, don't have any problem with those flavors, like they think of it more internationally and more of a, who cares if it's Israel? I mean, changing image of man says multiple times, like all the Western biblical ideas of God have to go.
Mm.
And people think, well, but what about what you're saying? Well, I don't think that the Zionist ideology, the religious ones, they're not, it's not classical theism like we think of it. It's process theology, which melds perfectly with the theosophists. And the reason it's part of a bigger project is the whole world is intended by most of these people to go into some kind of a controlled technocratic agenda. So you, like Alex said, I mean, there is a 100-year plan that the Chinese have. I mean, I'm right. sure China doesn't really care about Israel. I think one of their people was just lambasting the Israeli people the other day, saying, we don't care about your Israel stuff. So most of the world doesn't really care about Israel's, you know, greater project, Oded Yunnan project and all the Likud plan and all that. But of course, obviously they have a huge amount of influence in the U.S. government, with what did Netanyahu say? It's very easy to move.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So we all, I think we know this kind of stuff, but apart from particular like regions, the Middle East or whatever, there is this overall global plan that people have in the power structure that, again, you don't have to be wedded to or even care about it. There are plenty of anti-Zionist globalists like Brzezinski, somebody like that. He was like, Jews don't really like Brzezinski.
Right. But George Soros. No,
there you
not
go.
A big fan of Israel,
so,
yeah.
But, so it's bigger than this, but I'm not saying that it doesn't matter. Like, it does matter. I mean, the Rothschilds were a huge part of this, and they were kind of running the British Empire at one point.
Right, right. So. After Waterloo. And, you know, I feel like a lot of people think when they think of conspiracies, they think that, you know, the people in power are just omnipresent, omnipotent. They can do whatever the hell they want, whenever the hell they want. They have this list of things they're going to do and they're just checking them off the list. That's not really how it is though, right? They have plans. They try one thing. It doesn't quite work. They try another thing. Okay. Let's, you know, World War I didn't quite have the oomph we needed for the world government. Maybe we're missing a figure. Maybe we need that single figure to make the Satan of our new religion. We need a guy. How about Hitler? So, I mean, do you agree with that, that, you know, it's not so much these people are just sort of have a plan for the world and we're all just helplessly watching. They're having to react to how humanity reacts. Some of their plans work. Some of them don't. Some take longer than they think. It's not a foregone conclusion, is it?
Yeah, I don't think they knew for sure that the way that they wanted to goad, you know, Hitler into World War II, that was necessarily going to work. I think that they strategized and planned it. There's some really great they're somewhat disputed, but I think they're pretty revelatory. There's a great document called Red Symphony, and it's an interrogation of a guy named Christian Rakovsky. He was the Trotskyite socialist president of Bulgaria, and he was taken in by the NKVD because Stalin wasn't a huge fan of Trotsky. So he arrested him at one point, and the interrogations are all real. This one, some people debate it because it's so revelatory, but you basically have this lower level NKVD guy, I think his name's Gabriel, and he's interrogating Rakovsky, and he says, you know, what were you thinking by opposing Stalin? What did you think you would get out of this? And the guy says, oh, well, you don't understand that, like, we're going to get another war. We're going to have another, you know, there'll be another world war, and we're going to have eventually world socialism. And he mentions like some really prominent British spies like Sidney Reilly. And he says, we're all working for the Rothschilds. You don't know that. And
right.
the guy who's the sort of mid-level NKVD interrogator, he's like, how could we be working at the behest of banking capital?
Right.
We are socialist Marxists.
Right.
How could, it blows his mind. And if you think that's outlandish, well, why would David Rockefeller be such a huge proponent of Harold Lasky, the most famous socialist in America? He studied under him. He wrote under him, promoted him. And, you know, David Rockefeller wrote two, famous New York Times editorials in the late 70s about how big a fan he was of Mao.
Really?
Chase Bank was the first bank in China.
Right.
I mean, China. So, there is no antipathy at that level between Marxism, socialism, and big capital. To go back to Spengler, Spengler said it famously that there is no socialist revolution not funded by big capital.
Right. It's absolutely true. And I mean, not just big capital, I mean the American government basically built the USSR during World War II. I mean, we weren't just sending them weapons, we were sending them factories and trains and absolutely everything. Why would we do that if they're our big enemy? More with Jay Dyer on the other side. Don't go anywhere, folks. More to come.
I've been told for years to get bovine colostrum. It's the milk that a mammal produces as a cow in the first 2 weeks. It's the natural vaccine, it's super nutrients, it's growth factor, it's anti-cancer, it's everything. Ask ChatGPT what it's known to do. Upper respiratory tract infections and symptoms reduction. Attenuation of exercise-induced immune suppression. Antiviral and antibacterial effects. Stopping leaky gut. Support for gastrointestinal disorders, which is the whole body. Enhanced recovery and reduced inflammation, metabolic health, wound healing, and tissue repair. It goes on and on. And we have the non-pasteurized, super concentrated. It is incredible. Get your bovine colostrum. The first run sold out quick. Back in stock. And when you buy bovine colostrum, the highest quality at theoxygenstore.com right now, you get 50% off on all the other supplements, the methylene blue, the Irish Sea Moss, the Shilajit, the Ultimate Life Force, all of it. 50% off right now when you get bovine colostrum back in stock at theyellowshowstore.com, and it funds the second American Revolution worldwide. Now, I was out at dinner a few weeks ago after my dad had heart surgery, and my mom and my dad were ranting and raving about how great the bovine colostrum was they got. The last run sold out, but it's now back in stock for only a few days. If you buy it, already discounted, any other supplement, ultramethylene blue, the Shilajit, the Spike Protein Detox, Ultimate Life Force, they're all 50% off any other supplement when you get the bovine colostrum that's so incredible that's back in stock. Here's my parents at dinner. But, Mom, you were literally without me soliciting. You've been on colostrum now 2 months.
I know.
And we have the very best at theultrashore.com. And I'm serious. I didn't bring this up.
I have been on this colostrum for about 2 or 3 months, and a back problem that I've had since Alex was born is almost completely gone after 50 however many years. And my hair is much thicker than it has been, and I have good hair anyway, but it's much thicker. And this is brand new.
Turned darker.
And darker. Beautiful.
Who's convinced you to take it? Steve Heinberg or something?
It was Mary Heinberg.
Yeah, they're really smart. They're listeners. So, Mom, you got to listen. The products are amazing.
Well, this one, like I said, I don't do testimonials. There's a lot of good products. This is the first one that I can go, whoa, it really does work.
No, it's funny. I didn't even know the Heinbergs, I guess, because Steve and Mary, like a year ago, your house, like, you need to sell this. So we started, and we got the best brand. It's the strongest. It's no joke. The first 2 weeks of mammals, milk is totally different. It's like magic.
That back problem was from when you were born. I have a pinched nerve or something. I've never really known what it was.
No, you can blame my whole life.
And it has bothered me. And I just go through the pain because if you're going to have it, you're going to have it, right? There's nothing to do about it.
Well, I haven't asked you this yet. Have you taken the methylene blue yet?
No, uh-uh. I'm scared of that.
Really?
I'm scared it'll make me like Roseanne Barr. Not that she's not wonderful. Just kidding.
You're afraid you'll be... No, she came on the show like 6 months ago. And she said, I don't know if I can do it. She just felt sick. I gave it to her. She was bouncing off the walls 30 minutes later.
How do you proportion this?
Well, you know, for some people, a generic supplement choice that's less, you know, radical than the methylene blue, which is incredibly powerful, might make more sense. Something like a methyl drive, a power plant, ultimate burn even. But especially if you're talking,
talking
about younger people, methylene blue is radically powerful.
Absolutely. And then we've got the beauty claims. Love you, Charlotte.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
Welcome back, folks. This is The War Room. Jay Dyer in studio with me. And, you know, I hope the audience is like me and appreciates that while, yes, InfoWars tends to focus a lot on breaking news and political analysis of what's going on just in the immediate reality of planet Earth, we also have the leeway and the audience to appreciate that we can just sort of talk about history and how we got to this point and the whole timeline. Not just sort of reacting immediately to everything. So, you know, I think InfoWars is a very unique outlet in that regard. And I hope that you support us at thealexjonesstore.com, thealexjonesstore.com. I know it's been just ever since I started hosting a show on InfoWars, I always reveled in the ability to, you know, I'm going to take a segment just to ramble about Roman history. And I know our audience will appreciate it and not go, get back to the news. They understand how all this ties in together. And actually, the background is necessary to understand the present. If you don't know how we got here, how are we going to get out of the trap they're trying to put us in? So please do support this extremely unique and powerful outlet at thealexjonesstore.com. You can go to thealexjonesstore.com/Harrison if you want to let them know who sent you. Of course, Jay Dyer is the perfect person to have on in this regard. Jaysanalysis.com, YouTube, Jay Dyer, and on X at J_D007. we just continued our conversation like we didn't even go to break. So I'm like, okay, wait, where did we drop off? Where did we leave off there?
Left off at Cobra Commander.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's how we started, actually.
When I came in here, Harrison was in here watching like old G.I. Joe clips, and I was cracking yeah. up because there's a really good one that you should find on YouTube or on TikTok or whatever, where Cobra Commander actually creates Cobra Coin as a competitor to the Federal Reserve. And the funny part of it is everything that Cobra Commander is saying about the Federal Reserve being a scam is actually true.
That's awesome.
So we're going to create Cobra Coin. The Federal Reserve is a scam.
But he's actually
Cobra's
right.
Cobra's the good guy.
In this that narrative. Episode, Cobra's the good guy. And then the G.I. Joe's like, we gotta prop up the dollar in the Federal Reserve.
Nothing more American than fiat currency. Absolutely. Exactly. See, I never watched G.I. Joe as a kid, so I know, really, I've watched more of Alex Jones pretending to be Cobra Commander than I've ever actually watched Cobra Commander. So I saw that, I saw that TikTok video and I was like, okay, based. All right. I got a new show for my kids that will go on the approved list, I suppose. Well,
there's episodes on MKUltra. There's episodes on genetic engineering. There's weather modification.
That's wild.
All of that. And the reason for that, if you really want to know, I can tell you about it. I did a lecture on this one time in the UK. I forget the guy's name, but the guy who's involved in consulting on G.I. Joe is a Pentagon guy. So this is actually like, for people my age, this was like to make me want to be in
like
special
literal
ops.
Programming, yes. Propaganda.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it probably works. You know, same thing like, you know, Top Gun, you know, they always say that Navy recruits spiked 1,000% or whatever.
My dad went into the Navy from Top Gun.
From Top Gun. Yeah. Well, it works. And of course, that's sort of your speciality is looking into the hidden messages and everything. I know last time you were on, we were talking about how just the facade has fallen away and they're just outright satanic now at this point. And, you know, it seems like obviously the market is open for people that aren't pushing that to come in and scoop up some of that market share. And I know a lot of good people are doing that. For people like myself who have young kids, how would you suggest we, you know, navigate the modern media landscape? Just watch stuff from our childhood because that's basically what we do.
Well, it's funny though because when I watch, childhood stuff, like then you see the propaganda at that.
Right. Era, right? But it's just not as bad.
It's still pretty wholesome. I mean, we got so sick of movies that Jamie and I were watching a lot of noir films from the 1940s because I'd not seen a lot of those. And then what's amazing about those is once you know all like the World War II narrative, so many of those World War II films were also propaganda, especially like Humphrey Bogart films. Many of those are propaganda. In my third book that's about to come out, Esther Collingwood 3, I had a whole chapter on there's actually a network of British intelligence spy fiction writers that came to write a lot of those movies in the 1940s. So even, you know, Joan Crawford movies, Humphrey Bogart films, those are essentially films making America feel the necessity to be involved in
right
on the side of Britain. And that that was the job of some of those people coming over here for British intelligence.
You know, it's wild how involved British intelligence has been in American media since World War One. Although I think it was World War Two, didn't they had an office in the Rockefeller building in New York
City?
Yeah,
William Stevenson's office was there. His codename was Intrepid, and they set him up a specific propaganda office in the Rockefeller Plaza.
Isn't that crazy? So a British intelligence had an office in America to propagandize Americans into joining the war on behalf of Britain. And we just went along with it.
Yeah, and they were the ones that helped Bill Donovan set up the OSS. So it's Noel Coward, it's William Stevenson from Canadian Intelligence, Ian Fleming, and Stevenson set up quite a bit of things like that. But they were really telling Bill Donovan, okay, here's how you structure your intelligence apparatus.
Right. You need to and that's sort of the thing, isn't it? Any of these institutions, you have to go back to the guy who's done it before, which is why, you know, you're talking about Protestant and Catholic bankers, you know, even as far back as like the Middle Ages. But it's like for them to get money, who'd they have to go to? How'd they learn the craft? There were people already doing it before them. So that's why when you trace this stuff up the pyramid, you know, you honestly always end up at the Rothschilds. Because when you talk about intelligence and the way that, you know, by setting up five banks in five cities all over Europe, they just sort of in a de facto way established a method by which information could be transmitted quickly and safely between all these countries. So they therefore established a better intelligence network than the countries that they were living in, which is why when, you know, Rothschild went and started selling bonds after the Battle of Waterloo, everybody knew, hey, that guy's got the information. That guy knows more than we do. He's selling. We must have lost. That's how he, you know, buys up the British economy. But that's sort of, to me, you know, if you're tracing back the birth of intelligence, it you know, CIA to OSS to British intelligence to the Rothschild banking family.
Yeah, if you watch Wall Street, I don't know how cognizant Oliver Stone was when he put this in there, but the Gordon Gekko character, it's an excellent analogy of exactly what you're talking about, how when Charlie Sheen, who's the sort of blue-collar guy, and he goes to study under Gordon Gekko to become like the, you know, psycho Wall Street guy with the big fat, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Zach Morris cell phone.
The coolest guy in the world. Right. Yeah.
What happens is Charlie Sheen thinks, oh, this is all about sitting at the desk and, you know, spending all hours making the trades. And Gordon Gekko's laughing at him. And he's like, no, I want you to go get dirt on the guy. I want you to go sleep with this person. I want you to become an intelligence agent.
Right.
And you get the inside information. And then Charlie Sheen's like, that's insider trading. And Gordon Gekko just laughs at him like, yeah, that's how it works, dude.
Right.
So, just like we were talking about with Waterloo, the older banking structure is essentially an intelligence apparatus. I think Interpol comes out of that.
Right.
Rothschild Network as well. And so what they had figured out was secret societies are much like intelligence agencies, and they overlap with banking entities. And that's essentially what we have today is we're ruled by banker spies.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Technocrats.
Yeah. Spies working on behalf of bankers, or because obviously you can have a lot of control economically as a bank, but you can't kill people. You need an intelligence agency to do that. So the intelligence agencies have formed a sort of the enforcement arm of the banking cabal that, took power of the British Empire after the Battle of Waterloo.
Well, a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago, a bunch of big stories came out. Alex reported at the time. There was in The Guardian. It was in all the big papers, HSBC,
yep.
Big, huge mega banks, hundreds of billions of dollars of laundering drug money.
Yeah.
How do you do that if you're not connected to intelligence agencies?
Right.
Well, obviously they are.
And when you look at the document that we've covered quite a bit, I call it the Eagle 2 document, but it's a leaked document that was made by the FBI talking about the CIA drug running operation, how it got started, and basically it says, you know, at a certain point, this operation became so big, the CIA couldn't handle it, so it was, control was given to Baron de Rothschild, mm-hmm. and he was operating out of Paris with the, can't remember exactly what it is, it's not the Bank of International Settlements, but another organization like that that basically took control of the drug running operation that had been the black budget money generator for CIA.
Well, that's Gladio, and another intelligence bank connected to Gladio is Charles Hambro. And he was a Jewish British intelligence operative who started the Hambro's Brothers Bank, which was directly tied into all the Gladio Vatican Bank scandal. So this is not antithetical. It's not like, well, is it the Jewish banking or is it the Vatican Bank? They're all tied together.
Right.
Because it's a giant global network of organized crime. And if you study organized crime, and if you, you know, go listen to the interviews that I've done with Sammy the Bull, you know, he's very candid now, you know, many years after that life of talking about all these networks overlapping and how you got to grease the skids and you got to be in with the politicians. And, you know, he talks about, oh yeah, of course we work with the Jewish mafia where all the mafias work together. And so it's a big club, you know. I'm not a huge fan of George Carlin, but I mean, that's what Gordon Gekko, like, you know, represents there, right? And Gekko is a serpent, you know,
right. So. Yeah. That's super interesting. And of course now, they're rigging NBA games, apparently, the Italian mafia rigging NBA games. I don't know if you saw that, the gambling ring.
I didn't, but that's nothing new. I mean,
right. I mean, it's been going on since the World Series and what is it, 1911, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, and of course we've heard people like Ted Gunderson say, hey, look, you know, there may be a high value person that wants a child and you got to know where to get a child for them. You know, yeah, we got to break the law, but that's what we do. We're saving people's lives. So they really are able to justify anything and justify their, you know, partnerships with criminal enterprises because, hey, they can do things other people can't and we might need it for national security. It's really a very brilliant, you know, excuse to keep it secret and be able to do whatever the hell you want. Intelligence agencies really are the engine that keeps this New World Order operation moving forward.
Yeah, and they were set up by at least the OSS, CIA were set up, as we said, by British intelligence. But British intelligence, the modern security services, were set up at the turn of the century by Fabian socialists.
Right.
Who all had the same Milner socialist ideology. So to go back to that point that I meant to mention about Israel, a lot of the British elite were not pro-Israel.
Right.
But that doesn't immediately make them, like, good people, right? Yeah. So, for example, many of the British spies that are very well-known, very famous, you have T.E. Lawrence, you have Gertrude Bell, St. John Philby. St. John Philby became a Wahhabi convert, right? And that was whether he really believed it, I don't know, but he was working as a British intelligence operative with the Salafi, you know, strain of Islam so that the empire could have control and influence through that branch. And they ended up using them quite often because that's where we get this whole Al-Qaeda Mujahideen alliance that we use. And then Israel's now using that with Jolani and Al-Nusra and, you know, taking down Assad in Syria, Timber Sycamore, all those operations that, by the way, I was writing about Timber Sycamore in 2014 and, got called all kinds of names and, oh, you're such a crazy temple hat. And then it comes out in the New York Times, Timber Sycamore is the name of the project, billions of dollars. We didn't know the name of it.
What is that? Sorry, I'm blanking on what.
Yeah, just look up New York Times Timber Sycamore. That was the name for the billions of dollars that were sent to topple Assad back.
Oh, okay. Yes, got it.
Remember 2014, 15, 16, like that time? And it was like, you can't Mossad the Assad and everybody was.
So that was
what we were writing about, talking about. The White Helmets was one of these big propaganda operations that they were doing. They got an Oscar for the documentary. And of course, George Clooney was a big promoter of all that. It's not just Saudi money though. Look up, Timber Sycamore and you'll get the New York Times headline and it says, it came to an end. Well, it came to an end because like they ended up eventually toppling Assad.
Right.
And they put Jolani in. Jolani was the head of Al-Nusra back when they were trying to topple Assad, when the CFR was writing articles saying, we need, Al-Qaeda in Syria. Yep, that's it. It's on the front page of New York Times, but,
yeah, that's right.
They are Al-Qaeda.
Yep. And of course, you know, ISIS was mostly Saudi Arabia and a lot of people actually out of Europe that were radicalized in the Saudi Arabian funded mosques there. But when you look at the history of the Saud family, I mean, it doesn't go back that far. And that was a project of British intelligence as well, right? A British and American intelligence setting up the Saud family, which was just, I mean, it was basically just a bunch of barbarians. This one strong man, you know, got them all together and it's been him or his sons or his grandsons running the entire country ever since. You know, all of the princes, they're all direct descendants of this one King Saud who, you know, British intelligence picked as the vessel through which they would control the oil.
Yeah, the British carved up that whole area with the French, Sykes-Picot, and that's where we get Iraq from. We get Pakistan. We get Saudi Arabia. Those were all creations of the British Empire, and it was T.E. Lawrence that went and set up the Sauds. Mm-hmm. Gertrude Bell went and set up what was in Iraq. She's a pretty fascinating character. But what's interesting about those people is that they were not pro-Zionist.
Right.
They were Arabophiles. So amongst the British structure of the spies and the elites, you had these people that really loved Islam and Wahhabism, and which as a woman is really odd that Gertrude Bell would love Islam. But she was really into, she studied Persian, Farsi and poetry and Rumi and all this stuff. So she was an oddball, but she was working directly underneath, the British Foreign Office for the Middle East, which was headed up by a Chatham House Royal Society, Royal Institute for International Affairs guy answering directly to people like Milner and the Rothschilds.
Right, right. And you know, it was interesting. I was shown a clip from, this sitcom out of, the UK called, Yes Minister. I don't know if you've ever heard of that one, but it was a clip from the 70s and it's all has to do with, you know, political stuff. And they say, well, are you going to go give a speech about Zionism? He says, yes, of course. And of course, I'm going to stand against it and blah, blah, blah. And it was weird because it was at the time in the 70s, I guess it was just understood the average Briton and the entire British government was anti-Zionist, which was just kind of odd because
labor governments usually.
I think that's what it was. Yeah. It was sort of a reforming type of government that was in there, but it was interesting to me to see that in the 70s, it was just sort of assumed that if the British government addressed Israel in the UN, they would be against it and they would be against Zionism. And people don't know that it was as early as, you know, or as, you know, 40 years ago, that was the case in all of the UK. So things have changed quite a bit. And now you've got people, I don't know if you've seen the video, this guy's walking around he's walking around a protest where people are being arrested for like waving Palestinian flags. And he's going up to cops and going, I'm in favor of genocide. I want Israel to kill all of the women and children. Is that okay? And they're going, hey, you're allowed to have your opinion. That's fine. While people are getting arrested for waving a flag. So it's gone the other direction now. And people are literally being arrested for opposing Netanyahu or Israel in the UK. Again, is that like how does that happen? How does the UK help establish Israel, then become anti-Zionist, and now become so pro-Zionist that they'll arrest you if you're not? I mean, it's strange how all this just sort of happens and people don't notice the change.
Well, if you go back to like the time of the Balfour Declaration, like I said, like those British spies and the Royal Society elite, they were actually split between the pro-Arab, Arabophiles, and the Rothschild Zionist side of it.
Okay.
So they had kind of a division between them. You can even see this up into World War II when you have, you know, the king is basically a Nazi. He marries the,
right.
Wallace Simpson marries the American woman. So there was still the split, amongst that power structure in the UK. But when they, you know, when the King David Hotel gets bombed, it gets bombed by people from the Irgun, the Stern Gang, that becomes basically the intelligence apparatus and the military for Israel. That was, I think, enough to tell the British that, like, they wanted him out. But,
yeah.
But even to those periods that you're talking about, like, the Labor government was never really pro-Zionist. They were socialists. And if you're, some of the socialists were, you know, like Blavatsky and these kinds of characters, they don't care about Yahweh or the Bible.
Right.
So they don't have a problem saying, like, we don't care about Israel. We just want, like, world socialism. But then you have other people who are, you know, rabid Zionists, maybe not so much in the UK, but yeah, I mean, ultimately they end up fighting the same wars that we do because there's a special relationship, and it's the same power structure that runs the UK and runs us. The only difference is that with Keir Starmer, who is an open Fabian Socialist member of the Fabian Socialist Society, like, he's just an example of this hardcore technocratic worldview, rolling out the digital IDs, arresting people for tweets. All of that is explicitly what the hardcore socialists want. But not everybody is as hardcore, but that doesn't mean that they're good guys, because they're, you know, you can be anti-Zionist and be a bad guy.
Right, right. It's funny that you have to say that, but I was actually arguing about that with a guy on X the other day, because, you know, I had people reach out to me, you know, a month ago and say, how can you like Charlie Kirk? He's a Zionist. And it's like, you think that is my litmus test? If you're a Zionist, you're good, and if you're not, you're not. It's like, no. I got a lot of other concerns. That's a very minor concern as far as I go.
I'm about to cover a book called, it's a famous historical text. It's the collaboration between the Zionists and the Nazis.
Right.
But there's a book on the Havara Agreement. So they had to make these, I'm not saying they had the same worldview, I'm just saying they had to make these plans and these deals.
They did kind of have the same worldview in a lot of ways.
Right, certain ways,
you're
right.
You're talking about Kalergi. I think he was the one that coined the term master race. Maybe it wasn't him, it was somebody else, but, you know, a lot of the ideas from Kalergi were sort of, you know, it was Hitler going, hey, they're not the...
No, we are.
Yeah, they're not the master race, we're the master race. He didn't come up with it, he just took it for himself.
Yeah, Kalergi says that in Practical Idealism, Jews will be the master race of Europe. He said everybody else will be mongrelized.
Yeah.
His words, not mine.
Yeah.
But yeah, Hitler had a different idea that the Teutonic, you know, Germanic people would be the master race. And again, from the Orthodox Christian perspective, like, we don't see Hitler as a good guy just because he was opposed to usury and this kind of stuff. I mean, so were all the Orthodox kings and saints. Like, they were opposed to usury. Like, you didn't have, first 1,000 years of Christendom opposed usury.
Right.
So setting the bar kind of low to just be like, oh, I'm with whoever's against usury. Okay, well, I guess you're against the papacy then, because the papacy's pro-usury. But, yeah, I mean, the motivation we would say as Orthodox Christians that the mantle of Christian civilization after the fall of Byzantium, we believe that kind of fell to Russia.
Right.
Not that it was perfect, but it was kind of the preserver of the state apparatus of Christianity.
It was the Third Rome, right? In the sort of last surviving.
Exactly. The continuation. And then when that fell to the Bolsheviks, who many of which were Jewish, obviously Talmudic, they murdered the royal family on purpose in a ritual sacrifice. So, like, that leaves a vacuum, and, you know, it's odd, the only monarchy that's really powerful is the British monarchy.
I was going to ask you about that, because it seemed to me like that's what happened, is that the Rothschild sort of took over the British economy and therefore the British Empire, and then sort of systematically, you know, 100 years later, they're the only powerful monarchy left, and everything else is just sort of a symbolic, if they even exist. Obviously, Russia went down. France went down. That may have been related, but obviously became before. But yeah, it's like very clearly within 100 years, you have every other monarchy falling.
Well, the same motivation that promotes or that moves Napoleon to attack Russia, same motivation that moves Hitler to attack Russia. And I'm not saying that that makes Stalin or that makes communism good. The idea is to wipe out Christian civilization. And right. Even if you read Quigley, who is not, I'm not promoting him as a good guy. He's an admission text. Quigley says that the purpose of the two world wars was to destroy the remnants of Christian civilization, which he calls authority-based civilizations.
Hmm.
He says the modern world will be based on democracy and markets and consensus.
Yeah, yeah.
And the idea of the Austro-Hungarian Empire was a Catholic civilization, and Russian Orthodox Christianity and the Tsar is a Christian civilization. He says those have to go to have the new system.
Right. It's all so fat. Like, again, we could just get into all this stuff endlessly. The creation of the CIA and the Dulles brothers and their involvement in like the Treaty of Versailles. I mean, it's, this stuff is endlessly fascinating. I know we only have 2 minutes left, but let's touch on some modern and ongoing stuff here. What is your take on the, you know, Board of Peace to oversee Gaza and the inclusion of Tony Blair and these people in sort of an international body to oversee this land?
Well, I mean,
I don't know what to think of it.
That's nonsense. He's a Fabian socialist. He comes out of the same structure, of the Third Way, Bill Clinton, Tony Blair. They were at the same time under Quigley and people that have this kind of Third Way ideology. The Third Way ideology was this idea that you could combine, Western capitalism with Eastern communism and we would get this product.
Mm.
Dialectics, right? Dialectical synthesis. And that's really no different than the Fabian socialist model, which is the people above them anyway. I mean, he's Clinton's mentor. Right. So when I see Tony Blair and people like that there, who's Labor Party, it's the Fabian socialists that renamed themselves the Labor Party.
I didn't know that.
No, that's them. And the fact that they're like, don't care about Israel doesn't mean that they're good guys. They're just more openly sort of technocratic.
Yeah.
So you can have an internationalism that is like Israel focused, or you can have an internationalism that's like socialist focused and doesn't care about Israel. Well,
and
or you can have a Chinese one.
And there is sort of a weird sort of synthesis, right? Cause Tony Blair is obviously very good friends with Larry Ellison, who's helping to put on all this technocratic control, and is very pro Israel. So, you know, it's different factions, but they find common cause and work together quite a bit. Your new book is coming out. When can people expect your book? What's coming up for you, next?
Well, and to be clear about that, in terms of like, I'm not saying Blair is anti-Zionist. No, Blair was involved with Bush in fighting all those same wars for the Likud and all that. So I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there's always elements within the Labor Party, like Jeremy Corbyn, who was very, very anti-Zionist, but attacked in the British and Western media. I don't agree with Jeremy Corbyn, but I'm saying that he wasn't attacked until he was like making these sort of public anti-Zionist positions. But the book is Us Circling with Three, and it covers a lot of the big things that I never got to in the previous texts. So we cover some pretty big hitting blockbuster type films, a lot of Christopher Nolan stuff that I never got to, a lot of Marvel stuff. We go pretty deep into Kabbalah, esotericism, Lovecraft films, B movies, and Antichrist films. So Esther Collingwood 3 is going to be a unique installment in the trilogy. It's the finality of the trilogy there.
It's the way to find out the hidden secret meanings behind the movies that you may love. So if you want a deeper appreciation for what the filmmakers were really trying to do, you got to check out the first two esoteric Hollywood books, and the third one's coming out soon. You can find all of those and more at jaysanalysis.com. YouTube is Jay Dyer, J_D007 on X. Thanks so much for joining us, sir.
Hail Cobra! Hail Cobra!
We'll be right back, folks. Don't go anywhere.
I started having seizures like a few years ago, and everybody in my family knows I'm a neuroscientist.
What did you do to fix it?
Methylene blue.
I'd take it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mel Gibson was on here talking about it.
This stuff works, man.
I take it every day as well. And
yeah, RFK Jr. told me about it.
Yeah, man, it's fantastic.
What is Bobby Kennedy Jr. dropping into that glass of water?
Plenty of folks are wondering what was in that little bottle he uncorked during a flight.
Methylene blue.
Show her Kennedy taking it. Kennedy literally gobbles it.
He must be doing something right. That ripped bod is 73 years old.
You shouldn't have to tell a doctor about methylene blue. I think everybody should know about it. It's changed my life.
I knew what that did for me. I knew that it got me up and walking again, and I was having seizures without it. And I was bad, really bad. So I ordered it. I started taking it. And boy, let me tell you something. What a blessing.
For me, it's like a fog lifted, but it was like a veil lifted off, you know? Incredible. Best product that I've purchased so far.
It clears the brain fog where you're actually able to focus more clearly.
Let me tell you something. I'm walking without a cane. I take one pill a day of the ivermectin with the methylene blue. And I got to tell you, what a blessing. I am so blessed.
It is a miracle, and it's been proven for 100 years. It's one of the most well-proven drugs out there. My kids take it. My wife takes it.
Everybody takes it.
I used to have to pay what, $10,000 a week?
Right.
To get it in my arm and sit there for 6 hours a day to get it pumped in my system. And now I can take two pills or drink it once a day.
Right.
And pay what? I don't know. $30, $40 a bottle of it.
Depends on what the sale is. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's helping me to have a quality of life that I didn't have before that I have now. And I got to tell you, what a blessing. I don't care what anybody says. I know what it's like with it, and I know what it's like without it.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, third hour of War Room is on, and we're actually going to get to the news here, but I hope people do appreciate it as much as I enjoy it, the fact that we get to have these incredible guests on and not always be bound by whatever the breaking news is, whatever the latest headlines are. Of course, we like to cover those as well because you're so often being given a warped or perverted or distorted or just sometimes an outright false view of the goings on around the world. So obviously we have to, you know, keep up with all that stuff, but what would InfoWars be without, you know, an hour or two getting into the disturbing, you know, history of all this stuff or the disgusting reality of things like surrogacy that are being normalized at an incredibly rapid rate? And again, all of this stuff, as deceptive as it may be, it's actually all the same topic. We're on the same topic the entire time, whether we're talking about the early Rothschild investment in land and with, you know, outside of Jerusalem, or whether we're talking about babies being sold to gay men. This is actually all the same story being told that we're all living and main characters in. So I'm just so happy to have an outlet like this that can serve these interests. And I hope you support us by going to thealexjonesstore.com. Genuinely, we will, you know, we've got some more news here. I'm not going to comment on it because you know as much as I do if you watch The Alex Jones Show today. But yeah, it looks like, you know, it could be the real deal this time. We could actually be going down for good, like we've been avoiding for so long. So please do support us however you can. And the best way to do that is to go to thealexjonesstore.com and to go to alexjonesapp.com. Alexjonesapp.com is where you can get our brand new mobile app, which shot to the top of the charts on the App Store and is now available on the Google Play Store for your Android devices. Just don't ask what sigil the Google Play logo is modeled after. Just don't ask that. But it's okay. If you're using Google, it's fine. We know you don't know. It's fine. Every time I see the Google logos, they just look exactly like the demonology symbols that they're designed to look like. So I can't help but comment on it. I have a lot of videos to get to here today. I want to go to this one. Clip 16, this is from our friends and friends of InfoWars, Cafecito Break on X. Some really fantastic women that stood up very strongly against the lockdowns and the vaccine mandates in New York City. They're proud New Yorkers, but they're fighting the good fight. They're true InfoWarriors, and they were out there giving taking interviews. This one, I believe, is with Scott Libido, who is, of course, a famous right-wing artist. Clip 16 here. This is him talking about why Cuomo cannot beat Mamdani and Curtis Silva is the only choice for New Yorkers. This, of course, major topic as the mayoral race heats up. People are demanding that Curtis Silva drop out, even though Cuomo should really be the one to drop out. He's the disgraced one. Curtis Silva is a pretty well-established track record of his activity in New York, being with the guardian angels on the subway all the way back in the 80s. Here's the interview by Cafecito Break. Let's watch.
Cuomo cannot win. He cannot beat Mamdani. It's not possible. He is not going to get the votes. Curtis is the only one that can take this. And there's a week and a half for people to flip their script and realize if you really want to save your city, you have to back Curtis because Cuomo equals an extension of Mamdani. He's only going to get stronger. He's only 33. He's an aggressive, progressive, woke, socialist, communist, jihadi, and he's only going to grow if Cuomo wins. So you're kicking the can down the road. Everybody's putting a Band-Aid on a terminal cancer. You're not doing any, you're not saving it. This is the only time to save the city. Curtis is not going to be here in 4 years to try it again. Nobody's going to fill that shoe. Nobody's going to be here. It's going to be Mamdani again, and the city council, the assembly are going to be all of his cult followers. The city is lost forever. So this is not about saving the city and throwing Curtis out with the bathwater. Everybody needs to flip that script. You want to save this city? It's Curtis Sliwa. Move that energy over, and we are a lock. That is a fact.
Sliwa, Curtis Sliwa. I really like Curtis Sliwa. Everything I see from him is pretty awesome. Of course, Cuomo is a total dirtbag and should have dropped out when he lost the primary. What the hell is he doing there?
I also notice your cup is stained blue on the inside.
I've been caught.
You got a little, did you get, find some methylene blue floating around here?
I did, man. I commandeered some from Harrison's office.
Yeah, it's jonestore.com. Check out the supplements we have, 25% off apparel. Methylene blue, you can get for 50% off if you get a subscription and you never run out. So,
amen.
I know Stuart's going to be looking for a bottle. I'm going to go try to track one down for him while,
if you don't mind, I'm a bottle that pills too.
You like both? What do you like better?
You know what? I like them both.
Okay.
When I'm traveling, the pills definitely.
Yeah.
It's easier.
Yeah, it's not going to, you're not worried about it breaking open or.
No, on the way over here, I took a couple.
Yeah.
You know, while I'm driving.
Yeah. So with driving, did you feel more alert while you were driving or?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I took a couple shots while I'm in here in lieu of coffee. You guys ran out of coffee, so I went and got some methylene blue.
That's all he needs is a little methylene blue.
You're listening to The War Room with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now at x.com.
All right, welcome back, folks. This is The War Room. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, brought to you by thealexjonesstore.com. The mayoral race in New York City is getting a lot of attention these days, coming to the end. I guess they had a big debate yesterday, and Mamdani is, you know, clearly way out and ahead. And the rest of the vote is sort of being split by Cuomo and Curtis Sliwa. And people are calling on Curtis Sliwa to drop out. But Andrew Cuomo is a Democrat. Mamdani's a Democrat. Mamdani won the Democrat primary. Why is Cuomo still in the race? I mean, it seems like the only reason he'd be in the race is to split the rest of the vote to give the victory to Mamdani. And as a lot of people have pointed out, I saw a great chart. I actually retweeted it today. And we can bring that up because it, you know, just shows that there's really not a lot of air, not a lot of sunlight in between Cuomo and Mamdani when you actually look at the things that they support. How do the mayoral candidates measure up about public safety? And it shows that when it comes to defunding the police, to bail reform, to raising the age of, to be convicted, discovery laws, reinstating unvaxxed workers, repealing the 50th Amendment, parole for cop killers, public safety experience. Basically on all of those, Mamdani just takes what Cuomo did already and sort of accelerates it or expands it a little farther. But it's not, they're not different. They're just varying degrees of the same. Whereas Curtis Sliwa clearly has the much, much, much better policies when it comes to things like defunding the police. Mamdani wants to basically totally defund the police and get rid of jails. He literally wants to release 7,000 convicts from Rikers Island because jails is bad, y'all, and violence is just a social construct. I mean, the man is literally insane. And as much as, you know, New York is already a sort of giant dumpster fire anyway, it could get a hell of a lot worse. And I, you know, I love New York in a lot of ways. As an American, it's obviously symbolic of the power and grandeur that we represent. And, you know, going there, it's a very energetic and powerful city, and I would hate to see it in the control of a literal communist who seems only interested in serving the worst people in the world. And he's a fraud. And that's sort of an amazing thing about the Democrats is it doesn't matter to their voters that they're frauds. It really doesn't. And this is the case over and over and over again. There's a guy who's running for office in Maine as a progressive who apparently has like a Nazi tattoo. And he's just covered up. And, you know, they're like, oh, he portrays himself as this sort of down home country boy from Maine. You know, he grew up lower class, but it's like, no, it turns out he is like a multimillionaire, comes from like a very, very rich family. And it's just like, obviously, it's weird. It's weird. Same thing with Beto, right? Same thing with Mamdani. He's like literally like a Ugandan rich kid that was like a Nepo baby SoundCloud rapper for a while. Like he's just a weirdo who doesn't actually believe or stand for anything. He's like, says he's Muslim, but he is taking pictures with drag queens. And it's like, you're just a disruptor. You're just an invader. You're just a scumbag. You don't believe anything. You're not a real person. There are these compilations going around showing all the different ways he talks. But it's the same thing with Jasmine Crockett. It's the same thing with Kamala Harris. The same thing with all of them. They're all just complete frauds. I mean, the guy in Maine, it's like, he's a, you know, the commercial will say, you know, the progressive guy who grew up just down the road from you in Maine. And it's like, actually, he's a ultra wealthy Nazi, but it doesn't matter. They'll still vote for him. Like, it just doesn't matter. Zoran Mamdani, you know, homegrown New York City kids. Like, actually, his family has a compound in Uganda. And he's just like nothing. He's just nothing. But it doesn't matter to them. So, you know, it's weird because it's almost like, why wouldn't they just be honest? If it doesn't matter to the voting public, why do you portray yourself as something that you're not? But it's this weird thing with the left where they just want you to pretend. And once you pretend, they'll pretend to believe that. Do you know what I mean? Where like, you know, it to me sort of goes along with this idea where like, if they have something that they can point to as a reason they believe something, then you'll never convince them otherwise. You'll never be able to argue them into a logical standpoint. I don't know if I'm explaining this very well. Yeah, Zoran Mamdani celebrates wedding with 3-day bash in lavish Uganda estate. I mean, there was something where it was like somebody insults Zoran Mamdani. He responds from his compound in Uganda, and it's like, okay, is a supervillain running for mayor of New York? Is that what's happening? Anybody with a compound in Uganda has no place being a politician in America, but that's just me. But it's almost like, you know, like leftists know that Trump was never convicted of rape. But they'll call him a convicted rapist because some judge somewhere decided, just said, yeah, I'm doing that. And they go, okay, I'm declaring Trump is guilty. I'm declaring that actually he did rape somebody, and it was never proven. There was never a court case. They shouldn't actually be able to say that, but because some guy, some judge somewhere said it, therefore it is true. And even if you point out that it was never, it doesn't matter to them. It doesn't actually matter. So like, if this guy can portray himself as a progressive and a Islamic person and a radical LGBTQer, if none of it's true, it's all if it's true. It doesn't really matter. They just need a thing to pretend to believe in. Does that make sense? Because otherwise, they would change. Wow, who would have thought electing a rapist would have complicated a release for the Epstein files? Yeah, see, yeah, he's a rapist. You can call him that because some judge somewhere decided that he was. Yeah, just how it works. So, they can make laws off of the statement that white supremacy is the biggest threat. It doesn't mean anything. It's not true. It's just someone said it somewhere. They can pretend to believe it because it's useful to them to pretend to believe. You get what I'm saying about this? Because if it actually mattered, if they were actually, you know, I just go back to the Beto O'Rourke Man on the Street segment that I did, where there were three things that people pretended to love about Beto O'Rourke. They loved that he was like just a regular guy. Bootstrapped himself, you know, he's a small business owner. He didn't take PAC money, and he was Hispanic, so he understands the Hispanic, the struggles of Mexican Americans or whatever. And I would ask people, okay, is this what you like about Beto? These three things? They'd say, yep, those are the three reasons I like him. And then I'd point out, okay, well, his number one contributor is in fact a PAC. He does take PAC money. That's a lie. So that's one out of three of the things you liked about him. He's a billionaire, by the way. He married a billionaire heiress, and the company that he ran was just a side project her dad paid for. Okay, so he's not actually a poor person. He's not actually, you know, a bootstrap regular guy. He's a billionaire. And he is not Mexican. He goes by Beto, just literally explicitly to pander to Mexican people. His dad was a judge and was interviewed about his son, Beto. And he said, yeah, I want to name him Robert so we could call him Beto because that would get him votes in the Mexican community. The man was literally named. His name was a political stunt. The man was christened with a name designed to be a dishonest, cynical ploy to get votes. That's how, you know, dyed-in-the-wool political guy this is. But, you know, he presented himself as this outsider, as a small business owner. None of it was true, but none of it mattered. None of it mattered. So I don't know what is behind that Democratic mindset, but it's a fact, it's a reality, it's a constant, and we have to understand it if we want to actually defeat them. You can expose lies about their candidates. They don't care, actually. They'll continue to believe the lie, even when exposed to the truth. It's very troubling, but it's a very common thing. Anyway, I say all of this because I do think the mayoral competition in New York is a bellwether for what's happening in the rest of the country. It's concerning. It, in and of itself, is going to have an impact on the American economy as a whole, especially with all of the big corporations for now still located in New York. That might not last very long, but I'm sure they'll do some sort of exit tax where they'll try to bankrupt you if you attempt to leave the state, which, again, I do not understand how that's constitutional. California has that too. But Cuomo actually put out an ad. He put out an AI-generated ad about Mamdani that's very good. It's actually a fantastic ad, but I guess somebody criticized it, and so Cuomo deleted it. He never should have. It's actually a great ad, and it lays out very, very compelling arguments as to why Mamdani would be a terrible choice for New Yorkers. Let's go to clip number 17 here. This is the ad. The Andrew Cuomo campaign was too cowardly to leave up. Let's watch it.
Zoran Mamdani's opponents want you to believe he's an inexperienced radical whose policies will make New York City more dangerous. But what do his actual supporters think?
Mamdani isn't crazy.
He's just trying to even the playing field.
You know, give everyone a fair shot.
Sure, he said multiple times we need to defund the police, but that was just a metaphor.
And yes, he did say crime is a social construct. But that was also a metaphor.
His main backer, the Democratic Socialists, ideas are common sense, such as
decriminalizing misdemeanors, like shoplifting,
third degree assault,
trespassing, prostitution,
and drunk driving.
With plans to decriminalize all drugs, Mamdani will be a job creator for drug dealers.
Instead of helping us homeless get off the streets and into the mental health facilities we need, he wants to give us safe injection sites to do crack and let us sleep in subway carts.
These are actual policies Mamdani and the DSA want to implement on day one.
When a woman's being domestically abused, she finally won't have to deal with some pesky cop to arrest the abuser, but now a social worker to help, you know, kumbaya the situation.
Breathe in. Breathe out.
Mamdani is finally lowering jail sentences.
Guilty!
But Mamdani says you're free to go.
Woo-hoo!
Who cares if legalizing prostitution statistically leads to an increase for sex trafficking of women and young girls by 70%?
You can't have safety without equality.
For unlawful abiding citizens like us, globalize the intifada.
I'm a criminal. I'm a criminal. I'm a criminal.
I'm a criminal.
Yep. I'm a criminal.
For Zoran.
For Zoran Mamdani.
I didn't have a real job until I was 30, but sure, give me the keys to the city. What's the worst that can happen?
Paid for by Cuomo for NYC.
It's a great ad. Why would you take that down? Why did he take that down? I mean, let's find out why he took that down, because that was a great ad. Was somebody insulted by that? Was somebody offended? Did a criminal get offended? Did a human trafficker feel targeted by that? I wonder. He's exactly right. And it goes to what, you know, Caroline Leavitt was saying and got a lot of crap for a few days ago, where she's like, the constituency of the Democrats are Hamas members and terrorists and drug dealers. And people got mad at her for that. But it's like, okay, look at what they're doing. I mean, they shut down the government and have shut it down for like nearly a month at this point because they want illegal immigrants to get health care. Okay, so their constituency is illegal immigrants. There's no Americans that are helped by that. That's not their concern. They don't care. They're not trying to make life easier for the working people of this country. They're not trying to make life easier for families or women who want to have babies. They make it more difficult for them. No, their constituency, that is the people they care about and serve and pass laws on the behalf of, are the worst people in our society. Pretty much to a person. Whether that's, you know, and that was my thing is, you know, she's like, oh, it's Hamas and it's drug dealers and it's this. And it's like, well, let's not forget, you know, welfare queens, the indigent, you know, transsexuals, children, transsexual children, pedophiles, like they serve them too. They're always ready and willing to serve the interest of, again, just the worst people in our society and perhaps the world. Oh, it was a racist AI ad. Oh, it was racist, was it? What was racist about that? Let's scroll down. Let's see. Let's see what we got here. Official X account posts and then deletes AI-generated attack ad that prompted widespread denunciation. What? From who? New York City mayoral hopeful Andrew Cuomo has been widely labeled as racist after his... widely labeled as racist. That doesn't mean anything. I'd like to let you know right now that doesn't mean anything. You know what? Hey, watch this. Mamdani is a racist. Okay? There. Now, if three more people say that, then we can say that Mamdani has been widely labeled a racist because it doesn't mean anything. Criminals from Zora Mamdani, not even 20 minutes into the second mayoral debate, Cuomo's official account tweeted the video. It was reshared many times before being deleted. Cuomo and Mamdani did not immediately respond. The video, which has been saved and reshared, runs a little over 2 minutes and opens with an AI iteration of Mamdani first running through the streets of New York and then eating rice with his hands. Is that the racist thing? Because he does eat rice with his hands. Is it racist to depict reality? Yes, it is. It goes on to show a black man in a kippah shoplifting, a man abusing a woman, a sex trafficker, a drug dealer, and others all showing their support for Mamdani. Okay, what? They weren't all white? Is that the issue? They weren't all white. Only most of them were white. Is that the problem? Only the bad people were... Well, no, the bad people were also right. White. A black man dressed as a pimp trafficking a car full of white women? Cuomo needs to be thrown in the ash heap of history? Wait, who said this? Hold on, scroll up. Hold on, I don't see this. Who said that? Shannon Watts, the founder of Moms Demand Action, a grassroots organization that advocates for gun violence prevention, called it so gross and full of racist stereotypes, including a black man dressed like a pimp trafficking a car full of white women. Okay, what? So what are you saying? I don't even understand what that is. Is that that's a racist stereotype? That black men like white women, or that they traffic white women? That they're pimps? I don't understand what the outrage is there. It should have been a white guy. She would have been fine if it was a white pimp trafficking black women. Would that have been better? That would have been better, I guess. Algiers fault lines pointed to the imagery of the kippah and add on X. How are Palestinian New Yorkers supposed to feel about this? Or do they not matter? I mean, this is the type of stuff. It's like, what even is the outrage? And why would you bend to it? What? They're going to remake it where all the criminals are black. Is that what they're going to do? You know, in the same way that, you know, they want, you know, boardrooms to reflect the real population, maybe we need commercials that reflect the real prison population. Maybe that's what we need to do. So, yeah, the one thing the Cuomo does that would actually make me like him, making this cool and funny commercial, he immediately backs down on and denounces. It throws away. Okay, great. All right, great. Well, so you're a coward on top of everything else, huh? As if we needed to know more about why Cuomo is not the right choice. So yeah, for our New York viewers, and, you know, I have a lot of people who are out there going, I talk to people on the streets and nobody likes Mamdani. I mean, there was somebody today that was posting saying he cannot find somebody who likes Mamdani. Clearly he's got some support, but I wonder if it's as high up as we want. All right. So I've seen two black guys. Hold on. Should we count the races? Guys, we got to figure out how racist this is. All right. A black guy shoplifting, obviously racist. Okay. Zoran Mamdani is not white, so that's racist. Okay. That's two. Although, all right. So black guy stealing. All right. There's a white guy. There's a white guy. Okay. He's not fully black. That's a half white guy. I'm going to give him a half. All right. That's a white woman. There's another white man. Okay. Yeah. As you know, New York City, mostly white people are the criminals. It's mostly white people committing crimes. And these are the same people. All right. So we have 1.5 black people and the rest of them are white. And this is horrifying and outrageous and racist, according to dumbass communists. Oh, homeless guy. Okay, so the pimp's Puerto Rican. That's not white. All right, but the homeless guy's white. He's talking about being a criminal. So that's another one. So is that the same black guy as before? It is, right? He's wearing the kippah. Okay, so that still counts as one. Now, we're figuring this out, folks. Clearly, this is important. Clearly, this was important enough to take down the ad. So we can't make this mistake again. Oh, they're the social workers. White. What does that say? The judge is white. That's kind of racist. You're saying a black woman can't be judge, Cuomo? How dare you? Yeah, that guy's Puerto Rican. That's a different guy. What race is the lead singer of Outkast? I'm pretty sure he's whatever that is. Oh, look, a white guy burning an American flag. All right. So we have 1.5 black people, 6.5 white people. And that's racist, apparently. Hey, the pimp was white in that shot. So, yeah, okay. So they call that racist for some reason, even though everything, and for our radio listeners, if you're hearing that ad, for every claim they made, they actually showed an article or the law itself showing exactly, you know, what they're talking about. They aren't just making this stuff up. The things that they claimed, letting criminals out of prison, no longer charging drunk driving, like all of those have an article to go along with it showing you they're not just making things up. This is actually the things that they're proposing for New York City. You would think people would be able to tell for themselves that a mayor that wants to let everybody out of prison and decriminalize petty theft is not going to be a good person to run your city, but I don't know. But I guess people are going along with this. What even is the argument? I mean, everything I've seen from Zoran Mamdani, he's literally just like, every proposal is terrible. Every proposal sounds retarded, asinine. He's just like, we're gonna take over, you know, public buildings. We're gonna take over private buildings and make them public. We're gonna have city run grocery stores. And it's like all of this pie in the sky stuff that sounds good if you've never read history. Sounds good if you've never tried to run a business. I can make anything sound good. Is that what it takes? Can I run for mayor and promise just like complete BS and just get elected? Ice cream fountains on every corner? Like that really is the level that we're at. When in reality, it's like, how about before we do the city-run grocery stores, before we do the, you know, whatever else, LGBT pride parade, how about you try to make it so people aren't being lit on fire in the subway? Can we start with that? Let's start with the human immolation on the subways that are occurring. How about the horrific crimes? How about once people stop getting macheted in the head on the streets of New York, then we can talk about all the wonderful things you're promising for us. How about first you do the bare minimum to have just a functional city? Then you worry about all of the prizes and gifts for all of your supporters. People are still being murdered on the subway at a regular clip. So Gotta help New York City. Can the guys from Outkast be mayor?
I have said thousands of times, and I have said this hundreds of times to Trump personally, sometimes five, six times when I'm talking to him. Please stop saying it's on accident. Please stop saying they're incompetent. We can send you all the documents. It's on purpose. Here's who runs it. Here's who does it. Now, that was 8-9 years ago and off and on throughout that. Now he's got all his advisors, or most of them, and all the evidence, and you hear him more and more saying the Democrats are kamikazes. It's all on purpose. They hate America. They're Satanists. They want to bring us down. It's all premeditated. Yes, 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 because it's the truth. And when you tell the public, oh, they're idiots. Oh, they don't know what they're doing. Oh, they're so incompetent. Yeah, their constituents are, but not the people running it. It's the exact same leftist New World Order, BlackRock, UNWEF program all over the frickin' world. It is a premeditated evil attack in their own damn words. They are villains. It's not like, oh, they're just misguided fools. No, this is on purpose, people. That's what the Great Reset is. They're doing it on purpose. It's on purpose. On purpose. On purpose. On purpose. On purpose. So, this is what they do. They're scum. The opposite of competence. The opposite of trying to deliver success and excellence. Because they want to demoralize you and break your will. Remember how Gavin Newsom went, yeah, we can clean up San Francisco and L.A. anytime we want, but we only did it for Xi Jinping. He just went, ha, 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 ha. And as soon as he's gone, we're going to have everybody crap everywhere and murder and kill and zombie and needles everywhere. You remember? You want to see the clip?
I know folks say, oh, they're just cleaning up this place because all those fancy leaders are coming into town. That's true, because it's true.
Because they love rubbing it in. Well, of course now San Francisco's had crime growing out 98% in the last month, and it's totally clean. Yeah, we could have done it all along. But we ain't doing it for you, you dumb sacks of garbage. If the globalists are successful and we're in a giant collapse depression and you leftists are starving to death later, just remember you and your bosses did this. We're going back to feudalism, which is the most common political system in history, where the elites all over the world, whether it was in Africa or Asia or Europe or Mesoamerica, they kept people starving and under control and super poor so that they could never move out of that lower slave class. And America has been about getting rid of that. Doesn't mean we've been perfect, but damn it, we've done the best job. And they want to flush that down the toilet. Ooh, ah! And they're close to crashing the whole thing. And it's going to crash the whole world economy with 9 billion people, and all the actuaries are clear. War, carnage. I mean, it's just going to be hell, whole world. And the globalists said they're engineering it, and they believe they'll bring in their world government through that. But a lot of experts went, no, actually, you're all going to get destroyed, too. That's why a lot of elites said, pull back, it's too crazy, don't do it. Exactly. Even if you're evil and agree with the plan, it won't work. It's over. Disengage it now. It may already be too late. Trump's trying to save us, but you won't get out of the way.
Whatever the future may hold, InfoWars will always live forever. The fights will continue. Be sure to follow us on X at RealAlexJones and at AJNLive. And now you can download the number one news app in the world. Go to AlexJonesApp.com and let the Democrat Deep State Party know that we will never be silenced.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Final segment of the War Room is on. We have some very interesting things to discuss with you, including some breaking news, breaking revelation. From Steve Bannon. Of course, J.D. Vance left Israel today. Rubio will arrive tomorrow. So I guess this is a rare 24-hour moment where we don't have, a representative at the highest level of American government, bowing to the wall. But there's been, again, sort of signs of the division in the Trump administration and the Israel administration. Israel would, quote, lose all support from the U.S. if it annexes West Bank, Trump warns, seemingly putting the kibosh on Israel's Israel's dream of applying sovereignty to parts of the West Bank. Oh, my God. All right. This is from the Times of Israel. Do we need to do a little editing? Isn't this such an Orwellian way of phrasing this? Applying sovereignty to parts of the West Bank. What they mean is forcibly cleansing, ethnically cleansing and annexing. That's what it means when it says applying sovereignty. It's so Orwellian. Seemingly putting the kibosh on the Israeli right's dream of forcibly ethnically cleansing and annexing parts of the West Bank, U.S. President Donald Trump has said Israel would lose all support from the United States if it tried to move ahead with annexation. The comment published Thursday by Time magazine was made by Trump during an October 15th interview prior to the Knesset's passage on Wednesday in a preliminary reading and against the prime minister's wishes of a bill that would apply Israel sovereignty to all of the West Bank settlements, underlining this administration's lack of patience for such efforts. Trump's deputy J.D. Vance said Thursday, as he departed Israel, that the previous day's vote had offended him and was very stupid. And so Trump, again, he came out publicly and said this. This wasn't something that was referenced or written about. This was Trump himself looking into the camera and saying West Bank annexation will not happen. That's him putting his name on it, putting his foot down, and sort of challenging Israel to try it, right? Because you could say, well, we're talking about that. Well, yeah, I know they really want the West Bank, but we'll see. That's going to be a part of it. He could have said any of those things. What he said was, this will not happen. I will not allow it. And in response to that, while J.D. Vance was in Israel, the Israeli Knesset voted to annex the West Bank. The West Bank settlements are illegal under international law. And again, we've had weird cognitive dissonance from the Trump administration about this, where you have, well, and really the Republican Party overall, where you have like Mike Johnson going to the West Bank, making videos in the West Bank with some of the settlement leaders saying, yeah, all of this is going to be Israeli. We're very much in favor of that. At the exact same time, the Trump administration is saying, no, that's not going to happen. It's totally illegal. It's a violation of international law. So again, a little bit of inconsistency there, a little bit of dissonance between the two. There's more information from this Time magazine article that's very interesting. But obviously, with their dreams of Gaza annexation hitting some rough water and not going as smoothly as I think the Likud party would prefer, they've moved a lot of their attention to the illegal settlements in the West Bank and expanding those. We showed you the video earlier this week of the Palestinian old woman being beaten on the head by a Israeli extremist with a club as they, again, you know, forcibly annex this area, which by international law they have no right to. The UN recorded 71 settler attacks in just 1 week across occupied West Bank. So we're averaging over 10 attacks a day in this tiny area of concentrated terroristic activity by the Zionist settlers, colonialists. The attacks, many of them armed, resulted in the death of one man and the injury of 99 others, as documented by the UN Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Most of the settler assaults hit farming areas just as the olive harvest began, affecting 27 Palestinian villages. Nearly half of all the reported attacks tied to that harvest, which started on the 9th of October. So, of course, trying to destroy their livelihood. So that's what's happening in Israel as they also launched a bombing campaign against southern Lebanon today, claiming to be targeting Hezbollah infrastructure. I believe we actually, clip number 7 here, this was earlier today, the Israeli Air Force striking Hezbollah terror infrastructure in Lebanon right now, which again is also what we told you, right? When Gaza wasn't going to be their playground of genocide anymore, we go, okay, well, that means they're going to try to start something with Iran, or they're going to, you know, increase the attacks against Lebanon. But it really is like Israel is like a drug addict. Like, war is its drug, and it like can't go a day without it. And if it can't get the heroin, it's looking for the crack. Like, if They can't be killing Gazans. Who am I going to kill? Who can I kill? Lebanon. We'll just keep beating up on Lebanon forever. The Palestinians in the West Bank, who are just an endless pinata for Israel to beat. It's like, what? Who, these people, man. I mean, honestly, it is insane. And with this statement from the Trump administration, including J.D. Vance, saying this is not a smart move, voting to annex the West Bank, as a deliberate slap in the face of the Trump administration, right? Oh, you don't want us to do this? Well, then guess what we're going to do? And they go and vote to do this. And J.D. Vance responds and says, you know, we're not going to allow this. And there's people online going, who are you to tell Israel what we can and can't do? And it's like, bitch, your master. That's who we are. The reason you're here, that's who we are. We're your fathers. So you obey us. That is how this relationship should go. We created you. We can end you. And frankly, you're getting a little spoiled. We've spared the rod and we're spoiling the child. That's how the relationship between America and Israel should be. They should do what we say because they depend on us for everything. Talk about biting the hand that feeds you. And we put up with this? All we want on our side of the aisle is an American government that's American and that values America and does things for America's benefit. And when some little genocidal ethnostate on the crappy end of the Mediterranean starts mouthing off, we should stomp them into dust. Like, that is just how this should work. It's how this should be. It's not, because the obvious overwhelming and overt control of the American government that the Israeli mafia has been able to achieve over the last several decades, it's not going to go on for that much longer. I'm just letting everybody know it's not going to last that much longer. How it ends is entirely up to them. Whether this is a, you know, peaceful recapturing of the American Republic for the benefit of the American people, or whether Israel's going to try to take the whole world down with them, I guess that's up to them. But at least we have a president now making demands that are in opposition to the Israeli desires and aren't just folding the instant that Israel betrays us, as they always do. So let's go to a video of this. This is clip 10, Vice President J.D. Vance on this Knesset vote on West Bank annexation. Again, just a diplomatic spitting in our face. Let's watch.
When I asked about it, somebody told me that it was a political stunt, that it had no practical significance. It was purely symbolic. I mean, look, if it was a political stunt, it was a very stupid political stunt, and I personally take some insult to it. The West Bank is not going to be annexed by Israel. The policy of the Trump administration is that the West Bank will not be annexed by Israel. That will continue to be our policy. And if people want to take symbolic votes, they can do that. But we certainly weren't happy about it.
Again, great to see. I mean, even if it's not how I would respond necessarily, it's certainly closer to my stance than anything else we've heard from American administrations for my entire lifetime. So that's good to see. So I'm standing up against it. But the other talking point that's being thrown around these days, and it really is interesting how the pro-Zionist, the Israeli talking heads on X really conform to whatever the message of the day is, and they all say exactly the same thing. And it may be the same topic that they previously talked about, but they'll all have a different stance on it now. So like previously, if you talked about the money that we sent to Israel, they would say, well, actually, that's just benefiting American companies, right? That's all American stuff. So they're not actually giving money to Israel. They're just giving money to American companies. And that was retarded in the first place, because it's like saying, I'm going to give you $20,000 and then you give me that $20,000 and I give you a car. All that's happened is I've given you a car. So like, how you can be like, but I paid you $20,000 of your own money. No, we just gave you, we give you weaponry for free. And they try to portray that as if it's a benefit for America somehow. Now, the new talking point, they don't say that much anymore. Now what they're all saying, and we heard Ted Cruz say this in a speech yesterday, is that actually it's a bargain because we get access to Mossad's information for our measly $3 billion a year. For $3 billion a year, we get access to something that would cost us 10 times as much to build ourselves. And it's like, how many ways is this a ridiculous claim? For one thing, it's not $3 billion a year. It's been $23 billion in the last 2 years, and that's just the on-the-books official from one government to another transfer of money, not including all the NGOs and all the whatever else that we send them. So, okay, the amount that you're saying is something like one-tenth of what it actually is. Also, Mossad lies to us endlessly, and the information they do provide us is almost always false, including during the Hamas negotiations, where we showed the clip yesterday. Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner are saying, we're in contact with Hamas, they're accepting the deal, but we're getting intel from the CIA and Mossad, since we keep hearing about how we don't have intelligence in the Middle East and we have to depend on Mossad for it. I'm going to assume the information they were getting was probably not sourced at the CIA, but was rather trafficked through the CIA by Mossad, saying Hamas is never going to accept this. You should pull the agreement off the table and not go along with it. They were lying. They were lying. They were providing false information. Okay, so $3 billion, we get this amazing information from Mossad. Okay, it's more like $23 billion, and the information is almost always lies. And they depend on us just as much, if not significantly more, than we depend on them. And we don't need that information anyway, and we wouldn't need any information anyway, because there wouldn't be wars there anyway, not to the degree or in the way that they are, if Israel wasn't starting all of the wars. So it's like, oh, they help us solve a problem they started, but it still costs us billions of dollars. Great. Just incredible. Ted Cruz says $3 billion the United States sends Israel each year is actually a bargain, because in return, America gets lied to endlessly. So isn't that a bargain? Isn't it a bargain that we get all of this fake information that leads us into wars like the weapons of mass destruction? What would we do without that? So all we have to do is pay a measly $3 billion or whatever, $23 billion, and then we get access to lies that get us into wars that cost us $1 trillion. Thanks, Ted. Thanks, Ted Cruz. You absolute traitor. And actually, we have a couple developments in this regard. Some more clips from the interview that we did show yesterday with Jared Kushner and Witkoff, where they were talking about the way that they were getting fake information, incorrect information from the intelligence communities that was contradicted by their own on-the-ground firsthand knowledge of the situation. We also had – oh, maybe I definitely thought I put it in there. Maybe I didn't. Shoot. I might not have actually downloaded that. Guys, oh yeah, no, there it is. Clip number five. Let's go to clip number five here, because this is another very interesting thing that people noticed. Watch Jared Kushner's face when Steve Witkoff announces that everything happening in Gaza is in line with a plan that started 2 years ago. Let's watch.
Well, part of the plan is the reconstruction, the building, rebuilding of Gaza. Mm-hmm. And you're builders. You've been in real estate. As you said, it's extremely complex. Tell us more about the plan and how much it's going to cost, where's the money going to come from, and who's going to award the contracts? Three questions.
I think it's going to cost a lot of money.
What's a lot of money?
The estimates are in the $50 billion range. It might be a little bit less. It might be a little bit more. I happen to think that that's not a lot of money in that region. You have governments that are going to jump on in. And
so the Middle East countries are going to provide the money.
You'll see European participation and so forth. I think the beginning of this plan is how to get it going. And that's what me and Jared work on all the time. The money raising, we think, is the easy part. We think that happens relatively quickly. But it's the master plan, and we're working with a group of people who have been working on master plans for the last 2 years.
So there are plans already.
Yeah. We have plans already. We have a master plan already. And by the way, and Jared's been pushing this, and we're working together on it. And I think if the world saw the progress so far, they'd be pretty impressed.
So impressed. We're so impressed. Were you watching Kushner during that? He didn't seem like he was too thrilled about Steve Witkoff announcing that they'd been working with a group of people who'd been working on a master plan for 2 years at this point, that all of this is in line. Kushner's like, well, it's like, 2 years, huh? That puts you around October 2023. Okay, so you're saying this whole war has been in the pursuit of a master plan to annex and control Gaza. Wow, fascinating. This is the first time hearing of this. Yeah, no, we know. No, we're aware. We are well aware of the greater Israel project and the necessity to expel and, you know, forcibly depopulate the Gaza Strip so it can be annexed into Israel. No, we know. We know about the master plan. Don't you worry about that. You're just not supposed to talk about it. Sort of interferes with the master plan if you go around telling everybody about the master plan. Steve. Okay, so they're from Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner. Not that he wanted to be a part of it, but it's confirmation that basically everything happening in Gaza right now, or the at least the annexation of Gaza, was all part of a master plan designed around the time that the war in Gaza started, around the time that they allowed the invasion of Israel and the October 7th attack to continue unabated for hours on end, giving them the excuse they needed to go into Gaza. So it was all sort of planned from the beginning, wasn't it? So in the Time magazine article where they talk about Trump, you know, making some of the statements about the West Bank, there's some other interesting responses that he gave. He was asked, quote, "You've been in office for less than 1 year, Mr. President, in the second term, and the region, the Middle East, has already been transformed." One way of putting it. Hezbollah's leadership has been decimated. Bashar al-Assad has been replaced by a government seeking normalization. And Trump interrupts and says, "And you know, all of those attacks were done in auspices with, actually with me directly." Oh. So you're a terrorist? Wow. Okay. "President Trump, look, I'm like the top terrorist. Look, you know the pager attack where Israel caused every pager in Lebanon to explode, maiming and killing thousands of innocent people because it was just a widespread, totally undirected attack against anybody that happened to get their hands on one of these pagers? Yeah, that was me, actually. Actually, I'm the reason, just like I'm the reason they bombed Qatar, even though I'm mad at that, I did take credit for it." It's like, what are you doing, dude? It's the same thing that you keep doing. Clearly, you're not in charge of this situation, Trump. That's fine. We know that. It's actually worse for you to pretend that you are. I know this is not how his brain works. His brain recognizes that when you have this obnoxious little murderous chihuahua, Israel, leading you around, it doesn't look great. It doesn't look great if the president of the United States is making promises and then those promises are being betrayed. He's in negotiations and then Israel kills the negotiators. He's working something out with Qatar. Qatar gets bombed. He's, you know, why would you want to put your name on the pager attack against Hezbollah? That's crazy. That is genuinely crazy. Why would you want to take credit for the Bashar al-Assad government being overthrown when they've been replaced with al-Qaeda, who are currently carrying out massacres against the minority populations in that country? Why do you keep taking credit for the terror, sir? It doesn't make any sense. He's like, yeah, that was me with the pagers and all that stuff. He says, "And you know, all those attacks were done in auspices with, actually, with me directly. You know, with Israel doing the attacks with the pagers and all that stuff. So they had, look, they'd been, Israel's been very respectful of this country, and they let me know everything. And sometimes I'd say no, and they'd be respectful of that, but Obama treated Israel so badly." So, like, I'm pretty sure I understand his motivation here. I'm pretty sure I understand that he's saying the opposite of what he's saying. What he's saying is Israel keeps disrespecting him. He keeps telling Israel not to do stuff, and they do it anyway. And his response to that is say, actually, everything they do, they approve through me first. They won't do anything without my approval because I'm Mr. Big Dick. And it's like, okay, so you're a terrorist then, dummy. What are you talking about? So you gave approval for a bunch of kids and innocent people not involved in Hezbollah, doctors wearing pagers, being horribly maimed for life. That was you. You did that? Great. Thanks, sir. It's just insane. But I think it's pretty simple psychology, you know, motivating him. Now, there's been some breaking news from Steve Bannon, and it's sort of in line with what we're talking about. It sort of makes the most sense when you understand that, you know, Trump has, I think, for his own sort of power and self-aggrandizement, he has dedicate himself to the cause of Israel, because in return, they'll made him president and will continue to keep him in power. Here's Steve Bannon talking about how Trump intends to run for a third term in office. Let's watch.
Well, he's going to get a third term. So Trump 28, Trump is going to be president 28, and people just ought to get accommodated with that.
So what about the 22nd Amendment?
There's many different alternatives. At the appropriate time, we'll lay out what the plan is. But there's a plan, and President Trump will be the president in 28. We had longer odds in 16 and longer odds in 24 than we got in 28. And President Trump will be the president of the United States, and the country needs him to be president of the United States. We have to finish what we started. And the way we finish it through Trump, Trump is a vehicle. I know this will drive you guys crazy, but he's a vehicle of divine providence. He's an instrument. He's very imperfect. He's not churchy, not particularly religious, but he's an instrument of divine will. And you can tell this of how he's pulled this off. We need him for at least one more term, right? And he'll get that in 28.
You're not driving me crazy. I'm trying to understand the coherence of the things you've just told me in the last few minutes. On the one hand, you've said the Constitution is fit for purpose. Secondly, you've said that President Trump needs another term, even though the 22nd Amendment makes pretty clear that he cannot have another term.
Why does it make that clear?
Because he's on his second term already.
At some point in time, we will make sure we go through Zanny and define all those terms.
But even if you find a way to undermine you will be undermining the spirit of that amendment, even if you find some way around it. And to those
if the American people, with the mechanisms that we have, put Trump back in office, are the American people tearing up the Constitution? Would that be tearing up? Would the American people be going against the spirit of the Constitution, ma'am?
I think yes, actually, because what you will end up with is a populist justification for a quasi-dictatorship.
That's not true at all. Trump a dictatorship. Did you just see the compromises he had to make on the Big Beautiful Bill? You see the compromises he has to do on everything, on accommodating Zelensky, on what President Trump? President Trump is nothing but a series of negotiations to kind of keep this thing rolling forward, where he's having trade-offs all the time.
Telling me we have to smash the other side. There's no room for debate. There's no room for compromise. We must smash them. And now you're telling me this is a negotiation. I mean,
Steve Bannon announcing there's a plan to install Trump in a third term. Steve Bannon claims Trump, quote, will be the president for a third term, and Inner Circle has a plan. So we'll see about that. I don't even know how I feel about that. I mean, how old is Trump going to be at that point? Is that even a good move? Come on, guys. Come on. One of the things we don't like about the establishment is they don't know when to leave. They don't know how to prepare the next generation to pick up the torch. Now, so I don't know how I feel about that, but very interesting statement from Steve Bannon. Let's go to this video. It just broke minutes ago. Trump is actually asked is going to rebuild the third temple. Let's watch.
Go ahead.
Two quick questions. Back to the ballroom. It is a very spectacular ballroom, according to the renderings. And if it's half as nice as the one in Mar-a-Lago, then future presidents are really going to appreciate it.
They will.
Is there like an official name? Like, are we calling it the Trump Ballroom, or does the president have a vision for what the name for the ballroom is going to be?
There will be an official name. I will let the president announce that once he...
Charlie Kirk Ballroom.
Second question is, looking at these renderings, and it kind of got me thinking, he's likely going to go down as the greatest builder of this era, and you've been in on a lot of those meetings with him. Has, to your knowledge, has the subject of rebuilding the Holy Temple in Jerusalem come
interesting.
Up?
Feel the unstoppable power of Alex Jones, fueled by Ultimate Creatine Powder. This is the secret weapon behind his relentless energy. Creatine monohydrate ignites his muscles, blasting through lefts and sprints with raw warrior strength, building the physique of a true patriot. With micronized mixability, Alex dominates every day, recovering like a titan to crush fatigue and soar to new heights of performance. Ah! His mind becomes a fortress, sharper focus, unbreakable memory, powered by creatine to outlast any mental battle. This nootropic powerhouse defends against fatigue, keeping Alex Jones razor sharp for the fight. Join him and unleash your inner strength. Grab Ultimate Creatine Powder now at thealexjonesstore.com. Fuel your fight and rise with Alex Jones today.
That's pure gold. I'd have in between, like, maybe the creatine zooming in a little. It's coming towards you. But also, since there's 30 seconds left, you can have me go, baka chaka woom bak, quang quang kong, whatever it is. You know, that little, ooga chaka munga bak, woom kong kong. That'd be really good.